Hi, I'm Sean Baker, and I'm the director of Tangerine and the Florida Project, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Good. Okay, great. There we go. Okay, so the three of us can
just
pack up
our... Hold on. We should go back, yes, but it took us, what, 6 days to get here? And the coast is 2 days away.
You're saying that we get out by going deeper in?
Yeah, if you like, yeah.
Like? No, I don't like.
Gina Rodriguez with Natalie Portman in a clip there from the trippy new sci-fi film Annihilation. Writer-director Alex Garland's follow-up to 2015's also very trippy and very good Ex Machina. We've got a review.
Trippy makes them both sound so quaint. Get out by going deeper in. Also, a very good way to describe our approach to film spotting madness. Our fourth annual March Madness-style tourney kicks off this week with 64 movies from the 1990s. Only one will reign supreme.
We break down all 32 first-round matchups and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting Madness, Josh. Are you ready? We've been at it for a year.
I'm as ready as a guy can be who hasn't looked at the matchups at all, is ready to instinctually go with the first thing that hits his mind when he sees what pick he should make.
Well, that's actually part
of the way I play.
The fun for me throughout this process. You are going to get to react just like our listeners in real time as you hear them and give us your gut reaction as we pit these 90s movies against each other in our March Madness-style tournament. Listener votes will determine who advances. And maybe you're the kind of listener who skips an episode occasionally for whatever reason. Of course, that's totally fine.
Nobody does that, Adam.
Of course not. But you've got to stay on top of madness because these shows, they post on Friday. This one, you'll hear it on the radio over the weekend. You will be able to download it as early as Friday, March 2nd, if you subscribe to the podcast. So if you're hearing this, the polls for the first round matchups are live. You can vote right now at filmspotting.net. Go directly to filmspotting.net/madness if you want the swiftest way there. But they close on Monday. They close on Monday the 5th at 5 p.m. Central Time. And that's going to happen every week until we crown the winner on April 13th.
So you'll essentially have 4 days each round, which maybe sounds like a lot, but people tie themselves up in knots. Mm-hmm. They'll wait. There's one they can't decide. Maybe even try to fit in a viewing of
a lot of
film.
Homework going on out there.
Do some homework to help make your decision. But you got to do all that stuff pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're going to be like me Monday at 4:50. You're just going to pull it up and say, I'm going this way.
Yeah. We'll talk through all 32 of those first round matchups a bit later in the show.
But first, the sci-fi mind-bender Annihilation works something like Film Spotting Madness, the Tarkovsky edition, Solaris versus Stalker. In our review, Adam and I try to make sense of Alex Garland's divisive thriller.
Can you describe its form?
No.
Was it carbon-based?
I don't know.
Did it communicate with you?
It reacted to me.
You really have no idea what it was.
Did your husband contact you at any point while he was away?
No. It was his decision to go in. Why did my husband volunteer for a suicide mission? You have to tell me where he was, what he was doing. I need to know what's inside. I could see him.
Full confession right at the start here, Adam. I've had 48 hours to think about Annihilation, and I still don't know how much sense I can make of it. And it's not like I haven't had help. I was in Seattle over the weekend and took the opportunity to catch up with two critics and friends of the show, Jeffrey Overstreet, author of Through a Screen Darkly, and David Chen, host of the Slash Film podcast. Jeffrey and I actually saw Annihilation together Saturday night and shared desperate theories over drinks afterward. I hung out with Dave the next morning when I was still in a daze. Now, I appreciated their thoughts on the film. I encourage listeners to do some Googling to get their specific takes. But I can't say either of them gave me the key to appreciating the movie as much as its most enthusiastic supporters do. And I should note, both Dave and Jeffrey are mildly favorable toward the film. I'm going to stall a bit here to give you some time, Adam, but you can see where I'm going. I really hope you have that key. Annihilation is a movie begging to be unlocked. Natalie Portman stars as Lena, a biologist mourning the loss of her husband, played by Oscar Isaac, who disappeared while on a special ops mission a year earlier. Lonely and distraught, Lena volunteers for a top-secret expedition of her own, a research trip into a quarantined area where an asteroid crash has resulted in bizarre biological mutations. Inside this zone, along with fellow scientists played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, Gina Rodriguez, Tessa Thompson, and Tuva Nuvatni, she encounters bizarre plants, dangerous animals, and increasingly troubling flashbacks to the last time she and her husband were together. I'm sure you can sense the Stalker and Solaris allusions already, and we haven't even gotten to the wackadoo climax, which felt to me like a combination of 2001 A Space Odyssey and Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain. I want to be able to make some sense of all of this because there is much about Annihilation that I love. For certain, it represents an exciting leap forward in visual terms for writer-director Alex Garland, not that his debut, which we both love, Ex Machina, featured subpar visuals. Still, my inability to make much coherent meaning out of the movie is holding me back a bit. So I've come to the man with all the answers. What's Annihilation about, Adam? Or should I stop worrying about what it's about and simply learn to love the wild and often gruesome gorgeousness of it all?
Yeah, I think you should probably do the latter, but we as human beings can't help but try to unlock the meaning in what we're seeing and what we're hearing. And in fairness to you, I think almost anybody who goes and sees this movie in the theater, and I think it is just playing maybe in limited release. I know there's been a lot of angst about how Paramount or whatever studio is behind
Paramount.
It only gave it a little bit of a marketing push, and overseas, I think it's just playing on Netflix.
Yeah, they sold off the
rights. So our listeners over there can't even see it on the big screen. But Sarah and I managed to drag my wife to see it with me.
Oh, wow.
On Saturday night. I convinced the...
Knowing Sarah.
Yeah, the woman who
this was
hates,
not a great date night.
She hates overly weird movies anyway, and then she also hates really violent movies.
Oh.
And I would not say, actually, this movie is excessively violent, though there
it's gory, though.
There is some violence. There's a horror and gore aspect to it, without a doubt. But yeah, I'm trying to convince her to go see a movie called Annihilation with me. And the audience was... It was a good-sized crowd, and it was mostly, from what I saw, people like us, kind of 35 to 55 out there on a date. And it was really quiet the entire movie. And then the lights went up and we stayed up and get our coats on. And the couple behind us, maybe just a few years older, said, "Okay, so did you get all that? You're going to explain that to us, right?"
So everybody's looking
like
for
you.
This.
So everyone's looking for something. And I should say, how dare you not only give me such a difficult question to start with, but you give me a question to answer that would require me, I think, really to get into maybe what I think the movie's about, to spoil the ending of the movie. That's what's tough with some of these.
That's going to be
films.
A little difficult.
And I'd even, I think, have to spoil Garland's last movie for those who haven't seen it. You mentioned Ex Machina because I think the endings are potentially similar, or what I love about the endings are potentially similar. And maybe we'll save some of those details for a little spoiler talk as we get through this review. You mentioned a bunch of different touchstones. I still haven't seen Stalker. I've mentioned that even recently here on the show. That's a big Tarkovsky blind spot for me. I know that some people have made that reference here. I can't speak to that. I do see the Solaris element, and you're right, The Fountain, and what was the other one you said?
2001.
Yeah, perfect. If you've seen
the
this movie, yeah, if you've seen this movie and you get to the end of the film, you will definitely understand those references. But for me, honestly, the movie I kept thinking about was Arrival. The Denis Villeneuve movie from just a couple of years ago, 2016. You've got Natalie Portman and Amy Adams, they're female scientists slash professors. They've both suffered a personal tragedy, a loss in their lives. They're both trying to move forward from that. They're both brought in by government agencies to explore an unexplainable alien phenomenon, and it ends up being one that intersects with their lives in puzzling and perhaps even disturbing ways. And they do make choices. They both make choices in the end that potentially save the entire world from total destruction. And that's not really a spoiler because both movies do have endings that I think are completely up for interpretation. They do also, Josh, both use nonlinear structures that play off our understanding of how time is supposed to work, including how time works in movies. And I think we talked about that, if not in our review proper of Arrival in the spoiler talk, where we really got into that movie. We have certain expectations of how a movie is going to proceed or should proceed based on how and when information is delivered to us. And I think in Annihilation, too, we make assumptions about the type of marriage Lena and Kane, Oscar Isaac, have based on what we see in here. And of course, that's natural. That's what we're going to do. We're going to try to infer everything we can from those little clues we're given. But as new information is revealed, those assumptions are challenged. And to go back to Ex Machina for a second, I will say, without divulging too much, that it ends on an ominous note for humanity. Even if you are somehow happy about how the whole situation plays out, maybe you're rooting for a certain character to achieve his or her goal, it's ominous. And I think Annihilation has way more ambiguity to it, not in the sense that it's vague or doesn't commit to a position, but it does, for me, leave open the possibility of both hope, of beauty, and terror. At least that's how I read it. And that contradiction, that complexity, is really fascinating to me. Is there a key to unlocking it all? I do have a few thoughts that we can get into, but I'm going to stop for now. I want to hear your general take.
I would say maybe the ending has a bit of personal hope to it and a larger note of global terror.
Yeah, I was going to say a micro and macro difference. Yes.
Yeah. And I like the ending. I know there's some people who have trouble with it, but I at least had a firm enough sense of what was being attempted at that moment to be able to then take the baton and play with it myself. I wish that had happened more often in Annihilation, where I felt like I was in the game a bit more. And I think it's because it's just going in so many directions, all of which you could ascribe meaning to, but they don't really coalesce for me around a singular meaning. Now, a movie doesn't have to do that. Let me throw one out at you that came to mind for me that's not in this sci-fi realm, but I kept thinking about The Fitz when I was watching Annihilation. And the reason for that is because there's a movie that's absolutely mysterious. You know, the Golden Brick winner, about this girl's dance troupe that succumbs to seizures, unexplained seizures. And the director, Anna Rose Holmer, lends this sort of spiritual softness to depicting this, never really explains what's going on. For some reason, that mystery opened up possibilities of metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Ask five people, you'll get five different interpretations about what that movie means: spiritual awakening, onset of adolescence, whatever it might be. Theoretically, Annihilation should work similarly, right? Mm-hmm. It has all of this different mystery going on in it that could mean certain things. And I know some people have hooked onto one thing and said, this is why it moved me so much. But even when I've seen that, say, for example, one of the more common ones after I put some thoughts down and started looking around is how it might echo depression, this experience that Lena is going through.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, I see that here and there. But then I see very significant elements of the film that just can't fit that at all. And I think that's the hiccup for me. There's not this, and we can tie this into some of the aesthetic elements of the movie as well, which are gripping and really well done and visualized, but I can't piece all of them with any of these meanings I'm playing with. So there's not this thematic aesthetic coherence to it that I think a lot of truly great deep think sci-fi has. Now, does that mean I want to write the movie off? Absolutely not. It deserves a second viewing for sure, so I can maybe pick up on those things that I was missing, but that's kind of what my initial experience has been. And let me circle to where I'm heading towards, because this does bring us back to Ex Machina. So for me, I think at root, I can say that it's a lot about the same things Ex Machina is, which the basic question is, what does it mean to be human?
Yep.
The intriguing twist here is that question is asked in regard to the natural world rather than artificial intelligence. So what does it mean to be human in relation to nature, in relation to plants, in relation to animals? And how are we distinct as humans from that? Ex Machina was, how are we distinct as humans from computers, artificial intelligence? And here I see a through line for how are we distinct from the natural world. But again, there are elements to it that don't fit into that reading of mine
either. And that's not at all how I read it, actually. I see it as the nature element being just part of the larger metaphor that's trying to push a question, an existential question about what makes us human. But it's not about that comparison to nature, really, for me at all. And you're right, there are some different ideas about this movie floating around out there. I did read one, and I'll link to it in our show notes if people are curious, on Collider.com, Annihilation Movie Explained. And it goes very literal with the metaphor. I think I would say literal is the right term to use here, where it says the whole movie is actually about cancer. And it makes total sense once you think about it, because the Shimmer, as the place is described, is a large group of metastasizing, seemingly malignant cells. And it's growing.
And one of the first things we see is Lena's character looking
breaking
at cancer,
down cancer cells
so, under a microscope.
Exactly. So the movie makes that connection. And those cells, the Shimmer that's growing, could very clearly, that's the fear all of these characters have, it could grow to the point that it could kill the body it inhabits, in this case, the body being the planet. And then each character, even, their reaction to this cancer covers the varying ways people in real life actually respond to cancer. Some deny, some accept, some face it, some fight it. And that's all really interesting. And I think it's certainly worth considering. But that one-to-one type allegory, for me anyway, doesn't tell me anything I didn't really already know. It doesn't have the mystery. It doesn't have the poetry of the metaphor that I am seeking here. And I don't think that Alex Garland set out to make a movie about cancer, that cancer was his main preoccupation, and that's what he's trying to explore. I do think what he is preoccupied with is the way we as humans deal with life. And yes, that could be depression. It could be with our own mortality. It's a lot of things related to life. But really, there is, and I have to be vague here because I don't want to go into too many details, of course, but he is exploring a truth about the human condition and the ways that he can use a certain metaphor to explore that truth. And all three movies I've mentioned so far, Arrival, Ex Machina, and this one, I think they do just that in really fascinating ways. They reveal fundamental truths, but in new and unique ways. And I actually think you could make a case that Annihilation's truth, what it says about the human condition, is actually the least obvious of the three and the most mysterious, even if it's also the one where you mentioned, is there a key? I do think, unfortunately, and I say that because I don't really want it in retrospect. In the moment, I was so glad to latch on to this key and feel like it unlocked the whole movie for me. But it is the one movie of the three where a character literally spells it out about halfway through the movie. There is a conversation that takes place in this film between Jennifer Jason Leigh's Dr. Ventress and Natalie Portman's Lena, where I think she lays out the theme of the movie and that truth about the human condition. It's okay. Right there for you.
Yeah, I'm not recalling the specific one. I thought you were going to say the conversation Tessa Thompson has where she starts describing and really laying out the
that
actual
the
biological
plot.
Functions yeah. that yeah. are going
But not
on.
The metaphor so much for me.
Yeah, yeah. So, and we should also say, you know, we're not, I don't mean to say that the movie has to be explained to be successful. I'm absolutely content to enjoy a film that has a certain amount of mystery to it. Again, it's just the case of the mysterious elements not even working in concert to mystify me, I think is part of the problem. And that description from Collider about the characters representing, you know, these different responses to cancer makes sense. But if I don't find it effective, it's because I do think one of the faults of the film is also the characterization. I don't think that this is a very talented cast, and there is also a firm grasp on them as individual. They each have specific purposes and yes, responses.
And you don't like this?
No. What I'm saying is it felt very programmed. There was a programmatic nature to their existence so that I didn't feel them responding in the moment to these fantastic things happening. I never bought it as a realistic situation. It seemed like they were put here to move through certain paces in the script more than to be individuals. And I think it even sort of, you know, affects the Lena character a bit, though that's also tied to this kind of awkward framing device we get where she narrates the story. to someone else.
Yeah, that's the jumping around in time.
Yeah, that I don't think is as effective either. There are some structural issues as well with the film that I had.
I like that. I like the way it played with that structure and even gave us those little breadcrumbs, I guess, in some of those bits where she's transitioning the story and filling in a few of the blanks. I actually really enjoyed the group of women here, and not just because it's so fascinating to watch a sci-fi movie like this built around these five female characters, but if there is a sense of them being almost programmed, I think that ties into why they're there. I mean, they really are. The movie sets up for us that they almost were picked by design because they fill a certain role, not only within the scientific nature of this expedition, but psychologically. And so that was one of the more fascinating dynamics for me. And just the excuse of putting them together too was kind of great, where it's like, okay, we've sent in a bunch of troops of soldiers. We're trying to eliminate different control factors here. Mm-hmm. Everybody that's gone in has been a man. It hasn't succeeded. Yeah, let's see what happens when we put some women in there.
And military.
Exactly.
Too,
let's put some scientists. Yeah. And I think that is great. But each character for me really did hit a completely different register, whether one is the more aggressive and more expressive of her feelings, and one is the communicator and is trying to kind of keep everyone at peace. And then you've got the character who's completely introverted. And then you've got Jennifer Jason Leigh, who I honestly love here, who is just so weary and dour. And yet, because she's Jennifer Jason Leigh, can be really interesting moment to moment. And then even Portman, who I'll confess, I had a conversation with Sam about this the other day. I don't know overall where I fall on Portman yet as an actress. I don't. I really have not been able to put my finger on what makes her good or bad on screen. But I did really respond to her difference from the other characters is she wears her pain in a slightly different way and she is more stoic. And I did get that and appreciated that. But it's also her physicality. The way she stands seems to even reflect that kind of stoicism and that pain. She's just more bottled up and she's just sharper in some way as a physical character. And even the way she holds her gun, we know that she's someone who has had some military training. She's the only one in the bunch. And Portman finds, I think, fairly subtle ways to reflect that training, just even the way she's holding the gun, the way she's standing moment to moment. That really comes through in the performance. I did respond to that.
So that's a great scene when she has to use that gun. And let's just say it's during an attack with a creature they encounter. I like how this shows what Garland can do on a larger scale, on a bigger canvas. There are some really effective action scenes here that I enjoy that make this more than just a ponderous deep think sci-fi picture, though that's what it wants to be. It also has these really exciting moments. That's one. There's an encounter with, let's just say, a mutant bear that is terrifying.
And it's all because of sound.
Well, and that relates to what I was talking about before, this idea, without giving too much away, of what makes us distinguishable from animals, perhaps, because there is,
and when they
merging
it's
going
scary.
On. It's it's scary and creepy and eerie. It's also one of the highlights of the film that I'm trying to piece, okay, where does it fit into this notion of, in your case, what does it mean to be human? Mm-hmm. In my case, maybe a little more directly with this merging nature and humanity idea, but it's kind of outside of that. Fantastic action sequence, too. And there is the most befuddling scene to me that I can't wait to hear someone completely explain is also maybe its best. And this involves – it's in that weird climax. It involves a sort of doppelganger, we'll say. And Lena encounters this entity. And instead of using crazy effects, instead of going all CGI, we get – mime
physicality
and dance.
Yeah.
And here's where Portman comes into play. You remember watching it. Oh, that's right. She was in Black Swan. Yep. You know, another Aronofsky film,
another
head scratcher. And that is beautiful, unsettling. What happens in that sequence, I could have watched it continue as a ballet for another 40 minutes. No idea what's going on there.
I feel like I have more of an idea, just maybe slightly more. But it's funny. One of the thrills of this movie is being able to have these kind of conversations and thinking about it for days afterward, at least for me. That's for me ultimately the sign of a good movie, because if it was less coherent, then I would have just dismissed it. I would have walked out of the theater and really not cared.
Yeah, it's not at that level.
No, it's certainly not. But for me, what I really want most out of a second viewing is not to try to fit more of the puzzle pieces together. I want to actually focus less on the puzzle pieces and the grand overall meaning and focus on the aesthetic choices.
Yeah.
Because even watching some clips today,
right,
it reminded me just how beautiful, just how careful, how deliberate every choice that's being made here
absolutely
is. And yet overall, I still, and this is just maybe the English major in me, my instinct is to want to make sense of it all.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the notion of aesthetic thematic coherence. I mean, that is a value to appreciate
right
in a film. Otherwise, perhaps we're talking about an experimental work, and this is certainly not that. So we are discussing it according to different standards. One of those details, I want to spend a lot of time on those because there's so many,
mm-hmm,
is you describe the shimmer, and the walls of the shimmer are essentially, they look like a soap bubble. You can see through it, but there's a rainbow tint to it,
mm-hmm,
and it kind of glistens. Almost every shot when they're outside during the daytime, somewhere in the screen, there's a hint of that.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I just love that that little detail reminds us we're not in Kansas anymore,
yeah,
no matter how procedural the conversation,
mm-hmm,
that people are having, the characters are having, there's this eeriness just outside, just above their head.
Yep.
And there's so much stuff like that throughout Annihilation.
Yeah. It's a haziness, really. That's what it is this haze, this kind of subtle glow behind them. And it never feels like it's too computer driven or that we're in this fabricated landscape. It really does feel like these characters are inhabiting the space. And when one character, I think it's Portman, says the whole thing was like being in a dream, you get that. The effect of watching the movie.
Yes.
You start to wonder how much time has passed yourself moment to moment, scene to scene. So I really did respond to that overall. And those details, too. I picked up on one that I know others have as well, where it's a tattoo. It's a tattoo that moves and not on the same character. That does reveal something about what's happening to these characters that does in the moment make you scratch your head. And by the end of it, I think it's a little bit more clear. So I think this is probably a good place to stop.
Well,
or do you have a little bit more?
Let me ask you, maybe this is a better spoiler question. Okay, I've got two things. One I'll ask now. The other I should probably save.
Okay.
The one I want to ask now is about the score. And I'm looking up quickly here because Ex Machina's score was so crucial to, mm-hmm, the effectiveness of that movie. And it looks like it is, again, the same composers, Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury. I was confused by the use of folk guitar.
Oh, yeah. No,
music.
Actually, I really like that.
And then, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's some more of that atmospheric stuff they did in Ex Machina, mm-hmm, which is, you know, a more natural fit to what's going on here. But,
mm-hmm,
the folk guitar stuff was kind of jarring for
me.
No,
yeah. It worked for me for some reason. I think it's just because I always feel like it was placed within the context of her memory. And
yeah,
so we go back to it a lot.
You're right. But there is a sequence where it's still in the shimmer,
mm-hmm,
and that's maybe the emotional link that's attempting to
right
be made, but it does puncture that spell that you had described so well that it had cast. So
yeah,
anyway, just wanted to mm-hmm know what you thought of that. But yeah, let's move on to some spoilers so I can hear the grand theory and throw another question
well,
your way.
Yeah, don't know if I have a grand theory, but we will stop there for right now. If you have seen Annihilation and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. So we are going to get into a little bit of spoiler territory now. If you haven't seen Annihilation, I would say, too, if you haven't seen Ex Machina, then you probably should not listen to this conversation. Do you want to start with your question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Did you notice, because Jeffrey did right away, and we were trying to figure this out afterwards, David said that he didn't pick up on it, but the moment where Oscar Isaac is holding the grenade,
mm-hmm,
and being videotaped.
Yes. There's a voice behind him.
Right.
Yeah.
That he's speaking in like a southern drawl.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there why?
I think the answer to that is because he, as we know from the scenes that precede it, what's happening in the shimmer is all of these characters taking on the traits of each other.
Okay.
Including the tattoo that I referenced in the review proper.
Yeah.
I can't remember if it's the Gina Rodriguez character or Tessa Thompson, but one of those two I'm pretty sure, has this kind of figure eight style tattoo on her arm. And then all of a sudden later in the movie, Natalie Portman has it. It's somehow.
Well, Natalie Portman has it in the. Yeah, she actually references it when they talk about mirrors in the interview segments.
Right.
That tattoo but she didn't is go on into Gina
it. It's
Rodriguez
on one of them.
First?
She didn't go into the shimmer with it.
Okay.
But she comes out of the shimmer with it. So that's part of this whole kind of mutation. I think that that accent is he took it on from one of the other men in his crew.
So what we needed there then is at least a scene, and maybe it's there and I missed it, with that other
I think
soldier
maybe we get it. It's the scene where we watch the horror, what's going on in his intestines.
Yeah.
Now, it's not overly clear, and Garland here is not spelling things out, for better or worse, some of those details. But maybe we didn't get enough. But that's how I interpret it, because there's no doubt his accent all of a sudden completely shifts.
That makes sense.
And I think that makes sense. That's the explanation for it. But for me, the thing I mentioned as far as each one of these movies kind of having a truth about the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And there are complexities to these truths that I'm, of course, really narrowing down and simplifying. But Ex Machina said, we're all programmed to survive at whatever cost, right? Survival is all that matters. That's what the ultimate human trait is. That's the way I read the movie.
Okay.
Ava is almost more human
than
human.
She's human because she's pursuing that.
She's just pursuing that objective no matter what the cost is. So, and then, of course, at the end of the film, yes, she's free, but she's also so ruthless in her pursuit of living and existing in the world. She's the superhuman who will destroy potentially or subjugate in some way every human being around her that gets in the way of her survival.
Okay.
So that's, of course, what's terrifying about it. Actually, I don't think I made this comparison at the time, but just writing these notes down today, I realized that I think of Ava as like the character in The Thing. In the Carpenter movie. She's like The Thing.
Yeah, The Thing is another one we could have referenced.
She'll blend in. You're right, because actually
the body horror, the characters in
Annihilation and the body horror too, but they're constantly mutating and they are picking off these scientists one by one like in The Thing. But Ava's going to blend in until basically she's taken over everything. And that's what's really scary about it. So that's what's at the core of Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm.
Annihilation says, I think, conversely, we're all hardwired to self-destruct. And that's the conversation that Ventress has, where she lays out for me the theme of the movie. Ventress says to Lena that basically this is how we all are. This is why all of these women are on this journey. You've already heard a little bit about some of their problems. But no matter how great things might seem to be in our lives, we will find a way. And we know this from the flashback,
her marriage.
The marriage turns out wasn't happy really as we thought it was from some of those flashbacks. She had an affair that caused a problem, caused a rift, as you would expect in their marriage. And they became disconnected and alienated from each other. And basically, I think what the movie's saying is she probably had a quote unquote happy marriage. And yet she couldn't help herself but find a way to ruin it, to self-destruct. And the movie is saying that is our human nature. And that doesn't mean to destroy ourselves completely to the point where we don't exist anymore, but we are finding ways always, sometimes subtle, sometimes not subtle. Sometimes it's alcoholism, it's drug abuse, whatever it is. You will find ways to pick yourself apart and deconstruct yourself. And I think what the movie is saying is this is where the hope comes in some ways, and the beauty potentially is that the only answer to that is to actually embrace that change. It's to embrace that evolution, because through that deconstruction, only then is something new created. And that's why by the end of the film, I said it's terrifying, because like Ava, I see Oscar Isaac, I see Kane and Lena with that shimmer, with that glow in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They're now otherworldly creatures. And who knows what they're going to do when they go out into the quote-unquote real world, whether it's through some kind of infection or contagion or whatever. They're going to spread. They're potentially going to spread this, and the shimmer is going to be back and all of its destruction with it. But at the same time, and this is my last thing, at the same time, what's beautiful about it is that these two people who found a way to drift apart, who sabotaged their own relationship, have now become essentially different people, and yet have enough of their former self still in them that they recognize each other. And at the end, they're two almost new creatures, and yet they've come together. They've evolved to a point where now they get to start a brand new love with each other at the end of this film. That's beautiful and scary as hell.
Okay. I can see it.
There's a renewal. There's a rebirth.
Right. It, you know, And this is just a less hopeful reading, but it really only works for her in that sense. I don't think that's him. I think that's
different. I think they're both completely different. Honestly, by the end,
well, I think there's a distinction in that final sequence where the original Kane has a different experience than the original Lena.
I think that's fair.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's almost like, here's another one, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Like, mm-hmm. she's got the pod person of him now. So,
yes.
You know.
But again, with that shimmer and the fact that she's been changing,
yeah.
my sense of it, yeah, is she's going to continue to change. Kane has just fully changed, and she's not, yeah, quite there yet, but she's going to. But then there are two other moments then that I love in that. And one of them is, I love in that conversation where this new Kane comes back to talk to her and really doesn't have any answers, almost acts as if he doesn't even really know who,
right,
she is.
Yeah.
And when she keeps pressing him for answers, he says, "Does it matter?" And I love that because it almost just seems like a cliched kind of response. Well, why do all these questions matter? I don't have answers. But really what he's saying is, why do those questions and why do those answers matter? If you were so in love with me and you so missed me, here I am back in front of you. Now, she doesn't know how different he is, but he's saying, here,
right,
I am. Why isn't that enough to just embrace?
Well,
why does it matter?
Because she's detecting those differences.
Maybe,
like,
so.
That's, yeah.
Maybe so, but, yeah, but maybe not. It's early in that conversation, and she seems just to be very strict about wanting him to explain himself. And he's saying, if you, yeah, love me, I'm back. And then the last one is the other moment he says there, because he doesn't say much. It's very ambiguous. He doesn't have any information to share. But the one thing he says that I keyed into is he basically says he came back only because somewhere along the way, the movie doesn't explain it. Maybe I wish it did more, or maybe it does if I thought about it and saw it again. But he basically says that he came back only because he saw her and recognized her. This idea that he is off in this new world. It's not like Josh, I don't think the movie wants us to believe that literally he got out of the shimmer and like got on a plane or in a car and came to his old house. It's way more bizarre and supernatural than that. It's almost like he's, yeah, in another time and space, and yet he's looking in on his old life and sees her and goes, I'm not completely sure who she is even anymore, but I know, yeah, that I'm connected to her and I'm going to go to her.
I guess that goes back to, you know, the doppelganger episode, which is visually fantastic, but to hang on to that would be more, it would be more helpful if we had a better understanding of what exchange is taking place there with that actual figure. I mean, that would answer this basic question we're kind of wondering about. Mm-hmm. Is it him or is it a completely different entity? I also don't know how the Jennifer Jason Leigh, for one thing, you can't yell out the name of the title of your movie.
I was hoping it was going to avoid it.
Yeah.
But
how does that play into not only what you're talking about here, but I don't know how her exploding into, obviously, it's an act of self-destruction.
Yes.
But there's also, like, how does she know to do that, and what even is that? Those are the sort
right.
of things is like, you know, that we just need some context for it to have more of an effect, because we can understand thematically
okay.
she has cancer.
The difference,
she
yeah.
wants to – she does not want to live. So you can understand why this character might make this decision, but we need a little more context just for it to hit us harder. And I think – here's what's interesting. I read Ex Machina totally different.
Okay.
It's like, for me, what Ava is not human. And the ending absolutely concludes she is not. No, but she has not made that. What the whole movie is testing is, have you made that leap
right.
to humanity?
Oh, and I say she's passed with flying colors.
Yeah. For you, she's superhuman.
Yes.
For me, she has not yet, because the one trait she is unable
she has no
to
compassion.
Exhibit, which is tied to what you mm-hmm. agree, is like, she, you know, she has this will to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so do animals. And she
yes.
does, what she does not exhibit, is incapable of, is empathy. And there's kind of the dividing line, is like, she's close. Now you let something superhuman
uh-huh.
out. That's why that movie's so terrifying.
Right.
Something out into the world who absolutely all they have is that survival instinct. So here I'm thinking about, you know, all this nature stuff at play. The fact that Tessa Thompson becomes, we're assuming, another scene that doesn't entirely work, we're assuming she becomes one of those plant figures.
I guess, yeah.
Right.
Because she's transforming
and,
before us.
Yeah, she's transforming. And so blurring that line between humanity and the natural world, that what the heck is the bear creature? Like, is that a transformation where she's leaned into her sorrow and has come out the other end?
Well, that's where she – that's the woman, the first woman who got taken, right,
yes.
by the bear. Yeah, absolutely. And the last – yeah, that last scream, that last gasp is
– oh, my gosh.
Is where that transformation took place. Yeah, it's terrifying.
It's
terrifying. Yeah.
But again, I'm trying to figure out, like, in either of our readings, like
right.
in mine as, you know, how does that blur the animal, nature, human divide, or in yours where it's an expression of a basic element of humanity, like where does that fit in?
Yeah, no, and what you're saying is really interesting about Ex Machina, and I guess I'm – maybe more cynical, and I want to believe that empathy is, while a human trait, is not instinctual. It's something that not everybody has and that we have to learn, and we have to be open to it and embrace it. And what is fundamentally human is just that ruthless desire to survive.
Yeah.
I see it. I read it a little darker,
yeah.
I guess, that way.
Or the, again, to go back to the which this movie is doing, the animal-human divide, like... That's where these studies, like elephants, right? Like, what do elephants express empathy?
Mm-hmm.
Like, when they appear to mourn together as a group, and then where does that put them?
Sure.
So there are definitely questions about that at play in Annihilation, and maybe a second viewing I'll be able to piece
maybe.
Some of them together.
Yeah, I guess the fundamental difference between us on the film, especially it comes together in that last scene, is I think that there are just enough clues in context for it to cohere for me to latch on and wanna really try to dissect it and consider it even further, but not feel completely lost in the moment, even as much as like 2001, I'm going, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know,
right.
you're still having that kind of 2001 experience with it, which yeah, I appreciate.
I'll reiterate too, like I don't need to have it all figured out. Like 2001, I can't explain to you everything going on there. These Tarkovsky films I'm referencing, like they're completely mysterious to me. It's just maybe, you know, how you feel living within that mystery.
Yeah, that's fair. Again, if you see it, especially as we have spoiled it, maybe you have way better theories than us. We would love to hear those. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
We've got some last-minute Film Spotting Madness business to take care of when we come back. The results of our play-in polls. Then the official tournament begins. Stay with us.
That's the way nature is. I mean, the animal has his teeth, and the man has his fists. That's the way I was brought up, goddamn me.
Right on.
A clip there from director Charles Burnett's 1978 debut, Killer of Sheep. Burnett was awarded an honorary Oscar back in November at the Academy's Governor's Awards, and he's going to be recognized during this weekend's Oscar ceremony. Killer of Sheep was shot in the Watts section of L.A. over the course of a year in 1972-73, and it was Burnett's master's thesis submission at UCLA that went on to win a Critics Award at the Berlin Film Festival. It never saw a release due to complications with securing music rights, but was finally given a proper DVD release in 2007. And this is a movie that we both listed as one of our biggest blind spots on an episode, I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and vowed to get to it. And Josh, you fulfilled your vow with the Oscars coming up and that recognition for Burnett coming up. I don't know how you did it. Maybe it was all the time you weren't devoting to Film Spotting Madness.
It's amazing.
You devoted to this movie. I suppose you made a better choice.
It's amazing, Adam.
Well, tell us, did you make a better choice?
What you can accomplish when you're not making pairings all night long and spreadsheets. Yeah. No, I just, it's really one for years, even before we did that blind spotting list, I always meant to get to, never had the impetus, which is ridiculous because the movie itself should be impetus, and it certainly proved to be that. This is a wonder. And your note about the music rights, what's crucial about that is I can see why Burnett stuck to his guns, because the music in this thing is so important to how the film feels and works and really serves as character building in ways. I know scores can be used to do that and characters are given themes, but Burnett has like Dinah Washington here singing Unforgettable, as well as This Bitter Earth. I'll get back to that in a moment, but there are a number of songs sung by Paul Robeson. You've got Earth, Wind, and Fire. You've got Rachmaninoff in here, Gershwin. It all comes together to capture this main character's sense of malaise. This is Stan, the man of the title. He works in a slaughterhouse, and he's played by Henry Gale Sanders. And the first time you see him, you see his face, he's just a guy not at ease with the world. And the movie never explicitly explains why. He does. Here's the best sense I got from it. He's a guy who's trying to live on the right side of the law. He's working his ass off in this job, this really rough job. Yet he looks around his neighborhood and he still sees poverty. He sees frustration. What he's not getting anywhere close to is the promised American dream, basically. And this just weighs on him. But Sanders' performance is just a guy who you can't access. So how do you counterbalance that? Well, with this music that absolutely captures his inner state of being. And I want to go back to This Bitter Earth, because the saddest moment in this film is between Stan and his wife, played by Casey Moore. She's constantly trying to reach him. They're in their bedroom. It's almost in silhouette, embracing, not even really dancing to the song, but softly swaying. And you sense as she caresses him, maybe there's going to be a breakthrough here. Maybe for this moment, they'll find something to cling on to.
Lord, this bitter earth. Yes, can be so cold. Today, you're young. Too soon, you're old.
And he just leaves from her, too. And she's distraught. He doesn't really explain it. And again, the way the music, that song, This Bitter Earth, is such a, it's a piece of romantic realism that kind of recognizes how life can feel like a dead end. And that's what this movie captures, too. Mm. So a breakthrough in a lot of ways, but I want to give credit to Burnett as a visual filmmaker, too, because this is really what struck me, his use of the camera. There are a lot of images of children at play in these abandoned factory yards, throwing rocks and whatnot. An amazing tracking shot that follows a passel of boys as they follow a train that they're trying to throw rocks at. Another shot looking up at the sky from between two buildings, where you see some of these same kids jumping from one roof to the other. And there's something both freeing and constricting about that image. They're like birds that can't entirely take flight. You know, they just start to and then come back down to earth. So there are a lot of little touches in here that make it an absolutely remarkable debut. And it was interesting in context too, placing this with the Blaxploitation marathon we did a few years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, those films that we looked at mostly came out maybe a few years earlier. And those filtered brilliantly, we appreciated, the African-American experience through genre, you know, taking genre tropes and using that as the filter. And Burnett here is like, I'm just going right to the source. You know, I'm just going to, not that it's a docudrama and not that it's inert in any way or every day or feels mundane, but it's kind of like this is just going to be the experience itself filtered through this amazing music and imagery that I'm going to give to it. So, yeah, it's a great one.
Can't wait to finally catch up with Killer of Sheep, which is not currently available to stream, but you can probably find it on DVD, including at your local public library.
That's the route I went.
Okay, I actually do have a DVD copy of it. I want to say that maybe back in 07, when that release came out, they sent out some copies of it, and it's just been sitting there calling to me, and I know that I need to see it soon. Next week on the show, let's maybe decide this on air. Have an on-air production meeting.
Instead
as we
of
sometimes
Killer of
have.
Sheep,
yes.
We're going to
Wow. We're either going to go from sheep to sparrows, okay. And we will discuss the new Red Sparrow, Jennifer Lawrence, the spy thriller directed by Francis Lawrence.
That's right.
Who they did The Hunger Games, one of those movies together.
And
anyway.
Constantine.
Oh, okay.
As well. I don't know how much credibility that...
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
As I recall, one of those overlooked gems, Kumail Nanjiani said Constantine was a movie he loved.
That's good to hear.
He doesn't think is appreciated.
I am also a fan.
Okay. It's that, which is opening this weekend, or we could talk about the movie that just opened on Netflix last weekend, Duncan Jones, the winner of the first ever Golden Brick Award, the inaugural award, I think 2009, for his movie Moon, starring Sam Rockwell. He's got a new one out called Mute, and from what I have heard, because I literally have not even Googled this yet, it's been getting really bad reviews, for the most part.
I can confirm this,
okay.
Without having read any of them.
Yes. Seems like the general Twitter vibe is against this movie, and yet we have had many listeners on social media suggest, how can we not be talking about this movie from Duncan Jones, and maybe we should talk about it instead, and we've gone back and forth a little bit over email. Sam thinks Red Sparrow is definitely the way to go. I think that, hey, Red Sparrow might be entertaining and we might like it, but maybe that isn't the best conversation fodder, even if Mute is a big misfire. That still might make for better conversation. Sam wisely said, well, let's throw it out to the listeners. And, of course, that doesn't mean we're going to abide by what the listeners say, not if it doesn't jive with what we like.
Always that caveat.
But 375 votes.
Okay.
And as of right now, there are 11 hours left, but it's been a tight one. And as we sit here at this moment, 51% say Red Sparrow to 49 for Mute.
Okay. Little dispirited by the participation overall. I think that maybe that's
it's
giving
not as
us,
much as Film Spotting Madness.
Maybe that's giving us the answer we really need. Now, I'm going to lean with Sam and the voters and say Red Sparrow. I'm biased because I saw the trailer before Annihilation. Not that the trailer knocked me out, but
for
I've
Red
got,
Sparrow. Yeah, I've seen it multiple times. Not,
you know, and but I've got more to go on.
Okay,
and I don't know. I mean, I'd love to be the contrarian and come out
yes,
and say that Mute is a brilliant, misunderstood masterpiece. I feel like I'd have my work cut out for me.
Okay. Well, you know what? That's fine. I'll go that route.
Okay.
It seems the easier route to go. And
well,
it seems
easier,
like I might enjoy
okay,
it.
Here's
more.
The other thing.
Well,
too,
except,
though.
Except you're right. Netflix, we get to sit on our couches.
Would be to press play on your computer screen.
You are.
I
you
also
are right.
Kind of don't want to do that.
Okay.
You know, it's. If I feel like Mute's already got the odds are against it. And then if you're watching in that presentation, I don't know.
Okay. On air production meeting has now ended.
Adjourned.
A couple quick notes going back to our review a few weeks ago of Black Panther. And fortunately, no other listener has written in with this little tidbit. It occurred to me, I think the day we posted the show, we did our Black Panther review, and then shared our top five director superhero combos we'd like to see. And you had Dee Reese in there, who just made the movie Mudbound.
Yes.
And you suggested that you'd love to see Dee Reese's take on a Storm movie. And you even highlighted, hey, if that were ever to happen, which, you know, what are the chances, you would really love to see Dee Reese yet again collaborate with her Oscar-nominated cinematographer on Mudbound, Rachel Morrison. Somehow we both failed to note that Rachel Morrison has already done a superhero movie quite recently, the one we had just talked about earlier in that show. She shot Black Panther along with Ryan Coogler's debut Fruitvale Station.
Indeed, she did. Yeah, I think, you know why I didn't have the time to research that? Well, first of all,
we had just
directly
come
from the
movie.
But also, I was doing that in-depth reporting on Danai Gurira.
True.
And her connections
her
to
origins,
Grinnell.
Her birthplace.
So, I mean, really, which would you rather know?
No, that's a good point. I, of course, like the Grinnell connection. I don't think we said it on that show, but in between taping segments, you did point out that the note you saw was she was only in Grinnell, Iowa, one of the co-stars of Black Panther, until she was about five, and then her family moved back to Zimbabwe.
Yeah,
so
that sounds
maybe
right.
that explains why we never crossed paths during our
why
time
you weren't
growing
besties.
Up. No. So another note, and this is one that does cross into spoiler territory. If somehow you have not seen Black Panther yet, and you haven't seen The Last Jedi yet, and you don't want either of those spoiled, though I'm going to be honest and say these are very mild spoilers, but if you are sensitive to those things and you haven't seen both of these movies, then maybe fast forward about 45 seconds or a minute and a half into this episode. But I threw out during our review that there was a connection for me with The Last Jedi. There was something that is not intentional at all, but just struck me as somewhat interesting. And we got two responses. Both Reed Williams and Clay Clifton in Boynton Beach, Florida, wrote in with the same connection. Here's what Clay wrote.
I assume the tie you referenced between The Last Jedi and Black Panther comes in both films' final moments, when a little boy is awakened to the possibilities of a much larger universe. In Jedi, the Force-sensitive farmhand stares into the night sky, much as a young Luke Skywalker once stared at the double sunset of Tatooine, symbolizing all of us who yearn to join the adventure. Black Panther's ending is even more resonant. A kid in Oakland witnesses a feat of technology so advanced it may as well be magic. And behind it, a man who looks like him. Earlier in the film, the young Killmonger was abandoned in that same spot, left behind to forge a path of bloody vengeance. The child at the end will not be forgotten. He will be inspired by T'Challa's outreach to become a doctor or scientist or some other kind of real-world superhero.
Okay, I would love to say that that's exactly the connection
that's
I was not thinking
it.
Of, but I'm an idiot.
Oh my gosh.
And that's the much better connection. It's much, much better. Leave it to our listeners to nail it. And for me to look foolish, but actually...
Give us yours.
That's it. That's really a fantastic connection. The one I was thinking of is one where the context of it and the who and the how are very different. But just the way Black Panther is all about that character T'Challa having to confront the tradition of his country, the old way of doing things, the older values, and shunning those. And part of that is... Killmonger deciding at one point to burn up in flames that cavernous area where the formula is and all that stuff. It's as if he is taking the Jedi temple and saying, this doesn't exist anymore.
I believe it is even a temple.
There you go.
Okay.
So not a bad connection, but maybe not as good a connection is the way both movies end with that ode or that little nod to those kids, that next generation, which I found that ending not only of Black Panther very moving, but I loved that final shot of The Last Jedi as well for that reason.
I kind of like Clay and Reed's connection better.
It's better.
Sorry.
No argument from me, Josh. Our Vincent Minnelli marathon has begun. And if you are listening to this, you're probably a subscriber to the podcast. So you got that first episode in your feed. We started it with 1943's Cabin in the Sky. Michael Phillips joining us for that conversation about a film that is a curio for sure. It is Minnelli's debut movie. It's got some problems that have to be navigated, but as a Minnelli debut and as a film that stands out as one of only six films of its kind, and we talk about that a lot in terms of being an all-black cast from the period it was made, there are some remarkable elements and aspects to it.
Absolutely, yeah. We dug into a lot of that. Michael was great with some background and history and a sense of what Minnelli brought to that film as a designer in many ways before he even got behind a camera. And you know, if that isn't enough to convince you, I'll just say again, Ethel Waters.
Yeah.
Cabin in the Sky is worth watching for Ethel Waters.
She's great. Those marathon bonus episodes will post on Wednesdays for the next 6 weeks. That's our plan. We're going to try to do this one in order and knock it out. You can also listen to those shows at filmspotting.net. There are five more movies in the marathon. We go to 1944 and Meet Me in St. Louis next, starring Judy Garland. That full lineup is available at filmspotting.net/marathons. Our partner for the Minnelli Marathon is MUBI, cult, classic, and independent films from around the world. Every day, MUBI's experts introduce you to a film they love, and you have a whole month to enjoy it. There are always 30 extraordinary films for you to enjoy, so no algorithms at play here. These are experts who are curating exceptional films from around the globe, and every day they do introduce a new gem that you have 1 month to watch, whether it's a timeless classic, a festival darling, or an acclaimed masterpiece. And what I love about this sponsorship and this partnership with MUBI is that's what these marathons are all about. They're the perfect sponsor for them because they're all about us broadening our cinematic horizons, and often we are picking exceptional films from around the globe.
Listeners of Film Spotting can try MUBI free for 30 days at MUBI.com/filmspotting. That's MUBI.com/filmspotting.
One of the movies movie is playing this week is Werner Herzog's documentary Into the Abyss from 2011, where he looks at the legacy of a triple homicide in Texas, interviewing the victims' families and those convicted for the crime, including one man on death row 8 days before his execution. This is one of Herzog's more straightforward documentaries. I'm a fan of Into the Abyss and certainly recommend it. Maybe not one of his more ecstatically truthful docs, but still absolutely worth seeing. Again, that address is mubi.com/filmspotting. Josh, you have gotten back from Seattle. You were out in search for meaning.
Yeah.
Was meaning found at the festival, or was it found over many drinks with many film spotting listeners?
We found a little bit of meaning at the festival, but by far more meaning was found over drinks.
Uh-huh.
And then I forgot it. So it was there.
That's how it
works.
It's
gone. I don't know what to tell you. It was a great gathering, though. A really big group. We had, I think, about 30 who showed up for this meetup. And I loved how it was a chance for me. You know, sometimes when we run into people outside of the show, they'll say, oh, finally, I can match the face to the voice. Well, I got to do that with Melissa Taminga,
mm-hmm.
Sean Gilman, both of them. Melissa's been a co-host on the show.
Yep.
Sean jumped on.
Chimed in, top five expert.
Yeah, Wuxia
FAB
Films.
FAB member,
we
both
did.
Of them.
So great to meet both of those two in person. I also matched faces to some Twitter profiles, some other film spotting forum profiles. So a lot of people who are very passionate about the show. We did talk Minnelli, the marathon itself. We talked Madness, of course, and I'm afraid, Adam, three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri
yeah,
came up.
You know, I can't believe I'm going to plug this at all because Melissa's review of three billboards,
that's why it came up,
on Letterboxd, she's Letterboxd famous. Like, I think the most likes I have on any review at Letterboxd is, there's one maybe Before Sunrise has 200 or 250 or something like that. She's got like 1,400 likes on her three billboards review. And again, I don't want to plug it. I don't want any of you to read it because it hurts my feelings. Every line of it hurts my feelings, but it's there.
Truth hurts, Adam. And she's also doing wonderful work in the comments. That's what I said to her a while back. It's like, man, she is engaging.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I haven't checked lately, so she may have given up.
I had
up,
to unsubscribe.
But for a long time, she was engaging graciously and politely.
Right. But then the trolls came out.
It got a little ugly. But anyways, so we talked about that a little bit. There were a lot of kind words for you in general, Adam.
Oh,
it wasn't just, you know, ripping on
I was wrong about that.
So
I will not be linking to her review in our show notes at filmspotting.net. Just on principle. Sorry, Melissa.
Really, though, it was humbling, you know, to see what folks are using the show as a launching pad for. Get this. Anthony Zaragoza, he brought this syllabus for a film class he teaches at a Washington women's prison, which includes titles he included because of Film Spot.
Wow.
So
I want to know those titles.
Highly, I've got it at home.
You do.
I'll let you know. Highly doubt that that's what you and Sam envisioned when you first started this show, but pretty cool to see that it's got that sort of reach.
I haven't heard that from Anthony before, but other listeners, of course, have written in over the years, whether it's high school classes or college classes or some other type of educational arrangement. There have been a few of those, prisons and other groups like that, that have used films that we've talked about on the show, marathon movies and other reviews. And yeah, what can I say? It's heartwarming, it's inspiring, and we really do appreciate it. And I love the fact that you had as many listeners out there in Seattle. We've always said that Seattle would be a perfect film spotting live show opportunity, and maybe one day we'll do it based on the turnout at your meetup. We'd be able to sell some tickets.
Yeah.
Of course, you paid for their drinks, which we would charge them to get into our live show, so maybe no one would
come. See, that might be the crucial element. I don't think we should discount that.
Yeah.
Do I have to have my film spotting credit card cut
off? Yeah, I'm sorry, you're at your limit now. So your limit has been reached.
Did we wake you up with a text alert? That's all I want to know.
I got a text alert, and Josh mentioned something about I may have broken Maddie's record for a bar tab.
Yeah,
and
which
turns
I
out
didn't think was possible.
You
but
did. You did by a fairly considerable amount.
Oh, wow.
Now, here's the thing, though.
We had more people.
I shouldn't make you feel better about this. I should be making you feel guilty as hell. And all the listeners that took advantage of film spotting and poor nice Josh. But I want to say Maddie spent actually only about $120 less than you.
Okay.
Despite having probably a fourth of the number of people.
So I'm good. See?
So some of that.
So really, I think I was very responsible.
You probably were responsible. Some of that is New York, I suppose. It was a New York meetup, and it's probably pricier than Seattle. Yeah, but the probably. Other part of it is just Maddie and the degenerates that clearly came out to meet him. So, you know, you did break the record, though, and I'm going with that.
I feel much better about how it went.
Okay. Well, if you want to take advantage of film spotting in other ways, we give away movie passes as well. But the Seattle folks can't come. These are only for Chicago listeners. And one of those movies, Josh, that's available is Gringo. An American businessman with a stake in a pharmaceutical company that's about to go public finds his life is thrown into turmoil by an incident in Mexico. Good cast. Not only Charlize Theron, Joel Edgerton, Tandy Newton, and Amanda Seyfried, but David Oyelowo. It opens March 9th, and there is a screening Wednesday, March 7th. So if you want to see that for free and in advance of its release, you can do that by going to filmspotting.net/events. Now, Josh, you know what is not in our notes, but I know for a fact is going up soon on that events page.
What do you got?
Screening passes for one Isle of Dogs.
You're kidding me.
Isle of Dogs.
Why have you not alerted me to this?
Isle of Dogs. I just got the confirmation today. Monday, March 26th, there is a 7 p.m. screening here in Chicago. We're going to be giving away passes to the latest from your idol, Wes Anderson.
My idol?
Why not?
Sure.
Again, filmspotting.net/events.
Beware. Beware. Beware of the big green dragon that sits on your doorstep. He eats little boys, puppy dog tails, and big fat snails. Beware. Take care. Beware.
Beware indeed. Film spotting madness is upon us. Martin Landau as Bela Lugosi in Tim Burton's Ed Wood. Ed Wood in a barn burner of a matchup against Tim Burton's Edward Scissorhands. One of the 8 play-in matches listeners have been voting on in the last couple of weeks. The winners of those play-in matches advance to the round of 64 in this year's madness. We're going to call this Burton matchup live, Josh. We don't know the winner yet.
How exciting.
I'm going to click refresh. We're going to have the winner live.
There's all sorts of live stuff going on in this episode.
It's almost at 2,000 votes, and it's been neck and neck at moments over the past week. It's been tied, and we're going to get those dramatic results revealed here in just a little bit. Before we get to those, though, and before we take you through the entire 64-film bracket, we wanted to recap briefly Film Spotting Madness, what it is for any newcomers out there.
So it's a listener idea. We should probably point out first,
yes.
Mike Merrigan.
Blame him if you're not a fan.
If
Mike
you're not
Merrigan.
Enjoying yourself, all letters go to Mike Merrigan. About 4 years ago, he suggested this March Madness style tournament where listeners have all the power. So it's your votes that determine who advances. We started out with working actors and actresses.
Yep.
And that brought us to a finale of Michael Fassbender versus Jessica Chastain. That's why we now refer to him as Film Spotting Madness champion Michael Fassbender, because he won.
Yeah, I think actually, I mean, isn't that what they put on the marquee?
Yeah.
That's in all the credits. It's Film Spotting Madness champion Michael Fassbender.
It.
He did win in a squeaker 52-48. And Sam prods us with a good question. Would that be the same outcome if we did that madness bracket today?
I'm going to say yes. I don't think either
think
of
so
them,
too.
I wouldn't say they've been quiet, but that
he's
was right
more
about
quiet,
their peak, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, don't you think he's been more quiet? I feel like Chastain is actually now kind of coming into her own even a little bit more and getting more acclaim than ever. So maybe it would be a little bit even closer if we
possibly
did that again. Now, year two, we did working directors, Paul Thomas Anderson, not Wes Anderson, v. the Coen brothers in the final. The Coen brothers rolled through the tournament and they beat PTA in the final pretty handily, 62%-38%. And that brought us to last year's tournament, our Pantheon movies matchup. These are the films that we love so much. We've set aside, they're ineligible for Film Spotting top 5 consideration. And we threw in movies that have gotten the sacred cow treatment over the years on Film Spotting. And that came down to The Godfather versus a 90s movie,
mm-hmm.
Pulp Fiction in the final. The Godfather did win 62-38. So we're at year 4, the 1990s.
Chance for Pulp Fiction to get revenge.
It is the chance for Pulp Fiction to come back here and beat potentially another gangster movie. We'll get to those matchups here. But our 3-year plan is
Wait.
Yes, we have a 3-year plan.
Can you just say that again?
Our 3-year plan.
Thank you.
Hopefully we'll still be doing the show because we've got all the brackets figured out. We're going to do...
I guarantee you, no matter what happens to the show in 3
madness
years,
will go on.
You will be doing
Sam
this.
And I will make this happen. We will see this come to fruition.
In a basement.
It might be.
But you'll be doing it.
It might be. So, 2018, movies of the 90s. 2019, the movies of the 2000s. Do you know what they call the movies of the 2000s?
I've heard it referred to as the aughts.
Yeah, but guess what it's also referred to as? You can Google this and find respectable websites that call the 2000s the noughties.
I'm not going to be doing that.
You're not, huh?
No.
Okay. 2020, then, we'll do the films of the 2010s. So perfect with the chronology here. We're going to go 90s, 2000s. Then when we're ready for the end of the decade and we're reflecting on those last 10 years,
the stars
it'll be
align.
Time for madness.
It was like the universe was created to come to that moment.
You love it. I can hear the excitement in your voice. To select the 64 films that have made this year's bracket, it involved math.
Yes.
Sam and I used several existing top films of the 90s list, Rolling Stone, top 100 of the 90s. We did the AV Club and their top 50 of the 90s. That came out in 2012. Paste Magazine, their top 90 in 2012. Slant.com, their top 100 also in 2012. I don't know what it was about 2012 other than the Sight and Sound list that came out that inspired all that reflection, but so be it. We also did consider Flickchart, the movie rating website, for a more maybe populist slant on the popularity of these 90s movies. We considered it. We did consider as well, of course, our own rigorous objectivity. And for the most part...
What was that last part?
Yeah, you heard it. We emphasized best over popular or even, honestly, personal favorites. We did try to think about the totality of the 90s and the greatness of cinema and not just go with the movies that maybe me and Sam wanted to make sure were near the top. So... that does mean many favorite, many beloved films didn't make the cut. And that's what led to last week's top five. We talked about Titanic and shared our top five overlooked movies of the 90s. There were a couple of them in there for sure, including Lone Star and The Remains of the Day, that were incredibly tough to not see in the final round of 64. And Josh, 7 of the 10 movies that won Best Picture in the 90s didn't make the cut. That's how exclusive this company is.
It's an exclusive club.
It really is. Now, we have to note that once these polls open, they're only live for 4 days. They'll go live every Friday at midnight. So late Thursday night, they'll be up, and then they'll close the following Monday at 5 p.m. If you do follow us on Twitter, you can kind of get the best, most up-to-date information and some links directly to the voting. I posted a poll that I've never done with a Film Spotting Madness tourney before, and we've got almost 1,000 votes just in this question. I was curious how many of the Film Spotting Madness titles, 72 in total, because there were 64, but then these play-in matches, how many have our listeners seen? How much cramming, how much homework would there be on the part of our listeners? So your options were to answer the question, how many Film Spotting Madness 90s movies have you seen? All of them, I rule, or 67 to 71 of them, it's about 92% or 82%, 60 to 66. Maybe you've seen 53 to 59 or 45 to 52 or 37 to 44 or under 37. You've seen less than half of those 72 titles. Now, only 3% of listeners have seen all of them. They rule. How did the rest of the voting come out, Josh?
This is way more math than I can handle.
Mm-hmm. A lot of numbers.
18%, if I'm reading this correctly, of those who responded have seen about 90%.
Yes, over 90%.
Yep. Okay, 19% have seen about 80%
yeah,
of the films.
That's good.
Okay, then 20% here in the middle have seen 53 to 59 of
about
the films.
About 70%.
It's really pretty close
it
here.
It is close.
16% have seen 45 to 52 of the films, and then 12% have seen 37 to 44 of the films. Less than half, those who have seen less than half of the Film Spotting Madness contenders, that's 11% of those mm-hmm. who respond to this poll.
So pretty well balanced.
Yeah, it's pretty well balanced, but you know, there's going to be a fair amount of blind voting
yes.
here.
And that's something we did want to touch on. We've never actually stated this before, but I did add a little language to the voting page. I think Sam and I feel this way anyway. I don't know about you, Josh, but we do hope that people will only vote in the matchups where they have seen both the titles. Because otherwise, that will skew it, right, in
that's
favor
true.
Of the most popular movie. So over the years, when you look at the voting, the ones where you know a more obscure movie is in play, you can see that it gets fewer votes. So I think there is a substantial part of our audience who is doing
sure.
that already
sure.
without us admonishing them. But don't vote for the movie that you've seen when you haven't seen the other one just because you've seen it. Go ahead and just abstain.
Should we try to get them to sign something to agree?
I'm all for that.
They need to do that before
they can vote. There should be some more math involved in that contract, too. So look forward to that. Let's go ahead and get to the films that then have made the Film Spotting Madness 90s edition cut, starting with the results from those play-in matchups. As we touched on last week, we had a main character mortality play-in, Dead Man, the Jim Jarmusch film, versus Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. The Virgin Suicides was crushing Dead Man, 61% to 39%, but on a technicality, Dead Man advances because The Virgin Suicides is actually a 2000 film, so we will have to wrestle with Coppola and also her probably Lost in Translation as part of 2000's madness next year.
Yeah, Virgin Suicides will get another shot, but Dead Man Moves On is part of the official tournament. Our blockbuster play-in,
yep.
Jurassic Park versus Titanic. Got a comment here from Lauren Bycroft. Come on, it's got to be Jurassic Park. First off, I'd like to assure Adam that there are millennials out there, such as myself, that love both Jaws and Jurassic Park and know full well what the order of those films should be.
Yeah.
Jaws is always number one.
Okay.
I realize and appreciate that Titanic is a very watchable film and a great filmmaking achievement. I also understand that it is beloved by many people. But Jurassic Park, they built a life-size T-Rex and then made it run. Jurassic Park is also about a billion hours shorter.
Come on.
Don't discount that. Creates a true sense of awe and wonder and doesn't involve any endless debates about door sizes and buoyancy.
No sense of adventure, Lauren.
I think Titanic is really where Cameron started to put the world building, the technology, and the visuals before everything else. Spielberg, on the other hand, is often like the best bedtime storyteller you could ever have, weaving a tale, sprinkling some of his magic over it, and making it come to life right before your very eyes. There's just something about Spielberg's work that will always make it superior to me. It's got to be Jurassic Park. Mm.
And it is Jurassic Park.
Yes, it is.
If you look at the results, 79% going with Jurassic Park, even after our sacred cow last week when you tore down Titanic, and I tried gallantly to defend it.
Otherwise known as a mildly positive review.
Whatever. We all heard you destroy everybody's childhood out there with your take on
Titanic. I
think
I came down where Lauren was, watchable.
Mm.
She's about right.
I just want everybody to know this. I just want everybody who voted for Jurassic Park to know, and especially as you vote in this tournament, and you maybe try to actually have Jurassic Park advance, that behind the scenes, Sam and I are judging you. We're all judging you.
Assumed.
Just know that.
That's assumed.
Just know that we think you're crazy, that Titanic is by far the bigger achievement, the more interesting piece of art by filmmaker.
It wasn't
personal
it wasn't
piece
convincing
of art.
Last week, so just let it go.
You're all wrong.
Move
you're
on.
Just wrong. Okay. We're judging you. The Robert Altman play-in, 1992's The Player versus 1993's Shortcuts. Manuel says, another tough choice, but since movies are a visual medium, I tried to conjure up as many images as I could recall from both pictures, and I did stop here to think about what image he was going to write next.
Okay.
Mm. Well, Manuel and I think alike.
Did you guess this
one?
Oh,
yeah, I did. A naked Julianne Moore confessing to her infidelities, one out.
Hey, we all have our criteria, Manuel.
We do. And so Manuel voted for Shortcuts, but I voted for The Player, as did you, as did 68% of our listeners. So The Player advances.
How about the Krzysztof Kieslowski play-in, Three Colors Blue versus Three Colors Red? Here's Jason from New York. You mean Double Life of Veronique?
Yeah, should
honestly,
have been in there.
They're all so great. I'm happy with any of them. Beautiful, soulful films with terrific music and performances. Yet, despite that, there was a clear winner. 63% of the vote went to Blue.
So then we have the Man Against the Mob matchup, which I incorrectly called the Hitman matchup, thinking about Luc Besson's Leon the Professional versus John Woo's Hard Boiled. Steve Barbie in Apex, North Carolina wrote in to point out that Hitman isn't really accurate. We're getting into the technicalities here, but it's true. Even though one of the detectives in John Woo's Hardboiled is playing an assassin, he's really a detective. Both of the main characters are cops. So it's better listed as a Man Against the Mob matchup. And we heard from Patrick Najjar, who says, I genuinely like Leon, but this one is not even close. All it takes is a 3-minute long take action sequence for Woo to put Besson down for the count. Also, how can you vote against a film that has a protagonist name, Inspector Tequila?
Well, Neil Mitchell did. Here's his note. Leon, no question. Besson's best film. Jean Reno's best film. Natalie Portman, so unbelievably brilliant at such a young age.
Well, our listeners were decidedly with Neil. 71% to 29% Leon advances. Okay, this is a tough one. The war satire play-in. David O. Russell's Three Kings versus Paul Verhoeven's Starship Troopers.
Here's Chris Massa in Pittsburgh. We know him as the Massa Minute. I'm really glad to see both of these in the running, but Three Kings should come out on top. Not only is it the best movie to come out of the Gulf War, admittedly there's not much competition, but I'd argue that it might be the best war film of the 90s.
Well, the editor, in this case it's Sam, would like to point out that Saving Private Ryan and The Thin Red Line also came out in the 90s, but guess what? I think Three Kings is the best film of that bunch. Listeners, though, Josh, not with me. Verhoeven, moving on. Starship Troopers, 51% to 49%.
A tight one.
It was.
How about our smart high school comedy matchup, Election versus Clueless? Kate Fueo said, voting Clueless because its celebration of kindness and sisterhood is powerful and needed, because I want at least one female filmmaker in the bracket, because Paul Rudd's love-struck revelation face is one for the ages, and all kinds of other logical reasons, but mostly because I love it and am completely unashamed.
Okay, the results then, Josh, are?
52% for Clueless. Congrats, Kate. That was the right choice.
We also have a Toy Story play-in. The first movie versus Toy Story 2. Peter says, very close call, but I had to go with 2 for one simple reason: When She Loved Me. That song and that scene proved that Pixar could reach adult emotional heights. It is the precursor to the beginning of Up, which perfected it.
Fair enough. Sean says, I love Toy Story 2. It is every bit as good as the original Toy Story. 11th, Josh, really? 11th? All right,
yeah,
that's where
I
have it ranked in Pixar.
That's
ridiculous. Stand by it. Look at the films ahead of it.
Yeah,
I did. It's completely reasonable.
No.
Sean continues, but when it came time to vote, I went with the first Toy Story. There's just something to be said about being first, carving new creative and technical territory. And as much as I enjoy Toy Story 2, it doesn't work without Toy Story. You take away the original, and 2 loses its emotional impact and the depth of its character development. 11th, Sean says.
Well played, Sean. Okay, so everyone agrees with Sean. Toy Story wins with 70% of the vote, which brings us to our final play-in matchup, the one we are calling live. Tim Burton, only one of his films can advance. Ed Wood versus Edward Scissorhands, and we hear from Neil Mitchell once again.
Genuinely, hugely tough. One of my most cherished filmmakers, 2 utterly wonderful films. Ed Wood is touching, moving, complex, and beautiful, but Edward Scissorhands is one of those films that is so close to my heart it goes beyond critical thinking. Depp's very finest performance, Burton's very finest film, unquestionably my winner.
So I went with Ed Wood. You went with Edward Scissorhands.
I did.
And you did make a compelling last-minute plea, I'll give you credit, on Twitter, where you noted that even if we lose Ed Wood, and that's what happens to these movies, they are lost.
Yeah, we haven't said that.
No, we haven't said that. That's what you're voting for. The stakes of Film Spotting Madness are losing film goes into an incinerator, and it's never seen again. It's
destroyed.
Lost in a fire forever. No future generations will get to enjoy these movies. And you said, hey, if Ed Wood is gone, we still have Plan 9. It's not part of Madness, so it exists.
That's true.
And
I was looking for a way out.
That's pretty good. But if we lose Edward Scissorhands, what was your eloquent statement, Josh?
Something, the world would be a crueler place. Mm,
yeah.
Which
well,
is, that's, that is, it's
well
true.
Argued. Okay. Well, let's see if it paid off. Are you ready for the live results?
I don't know if I am.
1,925 votes in second place with 959. 49.82%.
Oh, wow.
Is Ed Wood. The winner.
Well done, people.
The winner
well
with 50.18%, 966 votes, Edward Scissorhands. 13 votes, it advances.
And I know what's going to happen. All that relief, it's probably
it's
just about
crushed.
To be paired up
oh,
with
yeah.
something that will
oh.
absolutely crush it.
Just wait.
Oh, my gosh.
You'll
Is
be voting
fiction?
Against it. You'll be voting against it in round one.
Edward Scissorhands, I cannot imagine.
I vow that you will be voting against it. So that at least will be the solace I take with Edward Scissorhands advancing. Okay, so those movies all advancing to the round of 64. Scissorhands, Toy Story, Clueless, Starship Troopers, Leon the Professional, Kieslowski's Blue, Altman's The Player, and Jurassic Park, which brings us finally to the bracket.
I've been in this room for 8 years now, Clarice. I know they will never ever let me out while I'm alive. What I want is a view. I want a window where I can see a tree or even water. I want to be in a federal institution far away from Dr. Chilton.
What did you mean by fledgling killer? Are you saying that he's killed again?
I'm offering you a psychological profile of Buffalo Bill based on the case evidence. I'll help you catch him, Clarice.
Anthony Hopkins in Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs, the movie that made it as the number 4 seed in our 64 film bracket. Just like March Madness, the bracket does, even though we don't lay it out this way, it breaks out into 4 groups of 16, each group containing that top seed. And we're going to break down the bracket now, one group at a time. We start with that 1992 Best Picture winner. The Silence of the Lambs is going up against Abbas Kiarostami's Close-Up.
How about that for a pairing?
Yeah. It's the close-up matchup. Lambs and Demme, famous for those intimate, uncomfortable close-ups. And a little bit of background here on why Silence is so high. It was number 4 on the Rolling Stone list, number 6 on Flick Chart. It actually didn't make the AV Club or Slant's Best of the 90s list, but we also know people love this movie. A lot of our listeners do adore Silence of the Lambs. Now, close-up, a low seed, obviously. A lot of people probably haven't seen it. We only finally saw it as part of our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon. It did make number 6 on the Rolling Stone list, and Slant had it at number 3, but it was kind of a revelation for me.
Yeah,
this is a really hard matchup.
Your favorite of the marathon.
Well,
I believe, right?
I had the mirror
that's
slightly
right.
Ahead of it, but Close Up was right behind.
Yeah, and Close Up, game changer for me. I think I'm going to go that way.
I really think
I'm going to. I don't know
why.
We're
not going to be right.
So,
but
despite your very clever thematic connection
there's
here.
There's a few of those.
They're like so entirely
they're
different.
They're so entirely different.
I feel comfortable going with Close Up.
Yeah. Close Up's the movie I want to continue to exist. That's where my vote's going as well. Our second matchup, Terminator 2 Judgment Day. James Cameron. Titanic's out, but James Cameron's in with T2. He's going up against The Lion King. The great 90s villains matchup, Robert Patrick's T-1000 versus Jeremy Irons' Scar in Lion King. T2 made all of the best of the 90s lists, actually, and Lion King made all of them but Slant's. Josh, is this a tough one for you?
Oh my gosh, yes.
It's
and
not for me.
There's,
it's T2.
There's a... See, here's an unfair reason why I'm going to go Lion King. As I said before, I was not involved with the seeding,
the selection.
Picking of the titles.
Nope.
But I am smarting from Beauty and the Beast not being included.
Yeah, you and other listeners
so
included.
That is the only reason I can feel comfortable.
You need some animation.
I need some animation. Terminator 2, I think, is the... I like Terminator. I know how you like to paint
Josh,
it.
Josh, don't.
I don't like the
don't
sewer.
Patronize
the
us.
Sewer romance.
Don't patronize
scene.
Us.
That's absolutely
that
brutal.
Was such a takedown. You know it.
So Terminator is a really good film. Terminator 2 surpasses it in so many ways.
Okay.
It is one of Cameron's best definitive action film.
But you're going.
But I've got to have the Lion King. I've got to have some animation, and we'll see how far that carries the Lion King for me into the tournament. It's carrying it past the first round.
Okay. We have now our epic movie matchup, which means both of them are at least 3 hours long. Heat, the Michael Mann film, versus JFK. Michael Mann's Heat made all of the best of the 90s lists except the AV Clubs, and Oliver Stone's JFK did make the Paste and Rolling Stone list. Do you have a clear winner here?
Heat.
Yeah, me too.
Yep.
Love Heat.
Just the cast.
Okay. I love everything about Heat, even as I also am a big fan of JFK, but an easy choice for me. Dazed and Confused, Richard Linklater versus Robert Altman. His movie, The Player, made it in. This is an ensemble movies of the 90s matchup. Linklater's Dazed and Confused did make all of the best of the 90s lists except for Pace. It was the number 4 movie of the 90s, according to the AV Club, and The Player also made all of the lists except for the AV Club. So are you going with Linklater?
Yeah, too strong to consider Dazed and Confused a game changer. I mean, I think it was for, you know, his career, for a lot of the people in that cast. And there are also, you know, just more personal attachments to that film, the way I respond to it, the things it captures compared to what The Player does. Mm-hmm. So The Player, clever, brilliant, satirical, but something I'm at a remove from. So for me, Dazed and Confused moves on.
Okay, we're in agreement there. That brings us to our Naked People matchup. Well, at least in name. Mike Leigh's Naked, the lower seed, versus Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, his sophomore effort that made all 5 best of the 90s lists. Naked made all of them except for Paste, and that movie features one of the best underseen performances of the 90s, David Thewlis.
Well, because I signed all of the appropriate paperwork in order to participate in this tournament, I must recuse myself. I have not seen Naked.
Ooh.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm not allowed to vote in this
one. That's one you have to see, and I have seen both. Boogie Nights, my choice. Malcolm X versus Krzysztof Kieslowski's Blue, the beautiful thespians matchup, Denzel Washington versus Juliette Binoche, and they both are so pretty. You could also call it the philosophical auteur matchup, Spike Lee versus Kieslowski. Malcolm X was the number 8 film of the 90s, according to Rolling Stone, and Blue made every list except for the AV clubs.
So I found my escape hatch here, and sometimes that's what you got to do.
Yeah.
I'll still have red, I'll still have white, but what'll I do if Malcolm X is gone?
Right.
Be really sad.
Yeah.
Malcolm X it is.
Clear winner for me as well. Now, that brings us to our This Aggression Will Not Stand, Man matchup. We've got the dude himself, the Big Lebowski, versus Truman Burbank in The Truman Show. 4 Coen Brothers films did make the bracket, the most of any director. So if you're looking for one of your little loopholes to get out of a choice
that'd
here,
be a good hatch.
You've got some Coen Brothers escape hatches here. Lebowski also made all 5 best of the 90s lists we looked at. Truman Show only made the paste list, and it was number 38 on Flick Chart. So The Truman Show, I will say, was one of those that, based just on the math, kind of didn't belong. But Sam and I really felt like it belonged, especially knowing how a good portion of our audience feels about it. And it's going up against a buzzsaw here in round 1, The Big Lebowski.
I'm glad you felt that way, because I'm going to vote that way.
No way.
And I know this will be heresy. I'm as big of a Coen Brothers fan as anyone. Heck, I put Hail Caesar as my number 1 film of the year.
Right.
I think The Big Lebowski is a little overrated. I think it has
Where's it at, number 11?
I would have to do 14? That list. It might be right around 11.
It's like that low.
Actually.
I know it is.
Yeah. Hysterical. Absolutely hysterical. One of Jeff Bridges, perhaps his best performance. But I think there are valleys to it. There are ups and downs to it. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Truman Show is very underrated, as that evidence you just gave me. Mm-hmm. I think it's incredibly prescient. I think you watch it every year of all this reality entertainment stuff we live in, and it becomes more prescient and valuable and insightful. So for me, it's a surprisingly easy choice to go with The Truman Show.
Okay. Well, it is a tough choice for me, because I don't think The Big Lebowski is the best Coen Brothers film, but I may rate it higher than you. I'm still going Lebowski, but I'll agree with you that it's not only difficult, but I underrated. I've said this on the show. I underrated The Truman Show when I saw it originally, when it came out in theaters. Didn't do much for me. Revisited it maybe 5 years ago. I don't remember what top 5 I was prepping for. And was really taken with it. So do not begrudge anyone who goes down the Truman Show path.
You know, though, don't we all have the best parts of The Big Lebowski always playing in our minds anyway?
Yeah, probably.
I mean, I'm not worried about the other generations. I'm mostly concerned with myself.
Okay.
And I'll be fine. Like, I can just cue
It'll
those
live on.
I can
the storytelling.
Cue those scenes up, and, you know, if I have to, I'll perform them for my children and say, this is what it was
you
like.
You will.
Voices and then we'll
too.
All sit down and watch the entirety of The Truman Show together.
Okay. Our last matchup for now. This is the one, Josh, I said was going to kill you. It's
one of
the ones that's going to kill you.
Did you engineer this? You did.
I have no comment.
Look at the evil glint in your eye.
I have no comment. I think
Sam wouldn't be this cruel.
I'm going to blame Sam.
No.
Edward Scissorhands.
This is the work of Kempinar.
It did advance, but it's facing in round 1. Groundhog Day. It's Groundhog Day.
So you know my argument here is that comedies are continually underrated.
Yep.
Groundhog Day is a brilliant comedy and deserves to go very far in the tournament.
Number 11 on the Rolling Stone list.
You're making me choose.
I'm making you choose. Only one of them can go on.
Okay.
Groundhog Day, the clear winner for me.
Really? Why? Well, tell me why, because I got to check something out a minute here.
Well, I think that Edward Scissorhands is overrated. As you'll recall, I think it's the only movie
I know you don't appreciate
it's gotten
Edward
the sacred cow treatment here on the show that I was way down on. That and Nightmare on Elm Street, which you also
tell me
adore.
Tell me why Groundhog Day. I don't need to hear any more Edward Scissorhands slander.
Well, I need to make a case for Groundhog Day. It's just one of the perfect romantic comedies ever. It really is, not just for the 90s.
That's a good point. Okay.
Bill Murray at the height of his powers? It really is.
I have something to grasp onto.
Okay.
I was wondering how this would play out. Star ratings are worthless.
Yes.
Except in bizarre situations like this.
Oh, man.
Okay.
You
now
went
on
with
Letterboxd,
Burton, didn't you?
On Letterboxd.
Uh-huh.
See, on my site, I just go with a 4-star rating system. If good enough for Ebert, good enough for me. Letterboxd gets fancy, but it's helpful here. Groundhog Day, 4.5 stars. Edward Scissorhands, 5 stars. I'm voting
5
Edward Scissorhands.
Stars.
That's right. That is right.
Okay, well, the listeners are not going to agree with you.
And I don't feel good about it.
I'm calling that. But at least you don't feel good about it. I knew we were going to give you some some real pain here in round one. And oh, the fun is just beginning, Josh. There is a lot more madness ahead. Stay with us.
Did you look in his citation book?
Yeah. Last vehicle he rode in was a tan Sierra at 2:18 a.m. Under a plate number, he put DLR. I figured they stopped him or shot him before he could finish filling out the tag number.
Uh-huh.
So I got the state looking for a Sierra with a tag starting DLR. They don't got no match yet.
I'm not sure that I agree with you 100% on your police work there, Lil.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That, of course, was Frances McDormand as Marge Gunderson in the Coen Brothers' Fargo. Fargo, the number 3 overall seed in this year's Film Spotting Madness Best of the 90s tournament. We've made it all of one quarter through the 64-film bracket. We are on to the next group of 16. And, Josh, it is Fargo versus Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, the class of 84 matchup.
Ouch.
Here. The breakout films for Jarmusch and the Coen brothers both arrived in 84, Stranger Than Paradise, the Coen brothers' Blood Simple, Fargo appearing on all of the best of the 90s lists we used to work out our seeding, and Dead Man made the AV Club, Rolling Stone, and Slant lists. This one seems like it's bugging you, because for me, Fargo is my favorite Coen brothers film.
Is it really?
The
okay.
Coen brothers are probably my second favorite filmmakers behind Paul Thomas Anderson. As much as I appreciate Dead Man, and as much as I need to see Dead Man again, and now I'm not going to have my chance, Fargo's a masterpiece, and it advances.
So what did I say about Dead Man just last show? Probably Jarmusch's best, possibly.
Possibly.
In my mind. Am I going to vote against the Coens again this early in the tournament? That seems unlikely. Yeah, it's Fargo.
Okay.
Gonna go Fargo.
Okay. That brings us to L.A. Confidential versus Glengarry Glen Ross. Great films by directors you could maybe categorize as a bit of journeymen. Confidential, directed by Curtis Hanson, who gave us 8 Mile, Wonder Boys, and The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Glengarry, directed by James Foley, who, yes, did 50 Shades Darker and 50 Shades Freed. Somehow haven't seen either of those yet, and this is also a Kevin Spacey matchup, as he was one of the most prominent actors of the 90s and appears in pretty prominent roles in both films. So which movie can you not live without?
How's this for logic? Foley directed 50 Shades Darker.
So you're using
Shades
that against
Freed,
him?
Neither of which I've seen, but still, for those reasons, I'm voting L.A. Confidential.
Glengarry for me. It's in
really?
The pantheon for a reason. I love L.A. Confidential, even though this could go back to the argument you used for a previous matchup, which is Glengarry's kind of like Lebowski in terms of how quotable
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, that's true.
And how in the collective imagination of at least a few of us out there it is. So I could just quote that movie for the rest of time, even if it didn't exist, and pass it on to my kids. I'm still going to go with that movie, written, of course, by David Mamet, adapted from his famous play. That brings us to Before Sunrise, another Richard Linklater matchup going up against The Insider, another Michael Mann film, his Heat also
yeah.
in the tournament. And Sam calling this our seduction stories matchup. You've got Linklater, that seduction, that romance going on there between Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. And then you've got Al Pacino's 60 Minutes producer trying to woo Russell Crowe's tobacco industry insider to turn whistleblower. Sunrise made a bunch of the lists. The Insider, tragically, made none of them. But this is one of those cases like The Truman Show, Sam. And I just felt like The Insider deserved to be among the best films of the 90s.
Well, it's no Beauty and the Beast, but I will say it's sort of a forgotten
yeah.
film in terms of how good it is. It's really strong. This is a tougher choice than it might first appear to be. That being said, it's got to be Before Sunrise.
It does.
Okay.
Okay. Sam probably doesn't agree, but that's fine. We're going to move on.
Really?
He loves The Insider that much.
More than Before Sunrise.
I think he might.
That would
I think he
surprise
might.
Me. Okay.
Eyes Wide Shut is up against the piano.
Oh, man.
Kinky Sex in Strange Locales
that
matchup.
That is a double feature,
also,
isn't
of
it?
Course, a piano does feature prominently. Nick Nightingale there, Todd Field, in Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. The piano, Jane Campion's movie, has a mute Holly Hunter hooking up with Harvey Keitel in 1850s New Zealand. Eyes Wide Shut made all of the best of the 90s list. It was number two on Slant's list. The piano, it was just on Rolling Stone, but it was all the way up at number 10.
Yeah.
I know you love the piano.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going the piano. No contest here. Although, I think this is among Kubrick's best work. I really like Eyes Wide Shut. It's absolutely masterful. But yeah, the piano is one of my personal all-time favorites. That you, I mean, if we did
that
a,
we completely
if we did
on.
A Sacred Cow review of that one,
crazy
you would be on the wrong end as well.
Well, we will avoid that then. Eyes Wide Shut for me. How about this one, Josh? I think you have a clear winner here, and I think we're going to be on opposite sides of it. Wes Anderson's Rushmore versus The Sweet Hereafter.
Yeah, it almost doesn't matter what the other title is, but I will say The Sweet Hereafter, magnificent film.
Really, I love it so much. Adam McGoyan.
Disturbing and moving and, yeah, a real work of art, but come on, it's Rushmore.
Yeah, but The Sweet Hereafter just destroys me, and even though I'm a fan of Rushmore, if it was up against the Royal Tenenbaums, that would be a tougher choice for me. Of course, that movie from the 2000s, so we will deal with that in the next tournament. How about two pretty popular choices here. The Shawshank Redemption versus The Usual Suspects. The your dad's favorite movie versus your brother's favorite movie matchup.
That's perfect.
Yeah, or the clever guys busting out of captivity matchup. Where are you going? It was number one, okay. Shawshank, on the flick chart list, but it did also make Rolling Stone and Paste. And Usual Suspects was number nine on flick chart. It also made Rolling Stone and Paste.
Yeah, that description really captures it for me. These are two beloved films that I just, you know, I kind of shrug my shoulders at. Let's do this. This side is Shawshank. This side is Usual Suspects. I'm going to shrug my shoulders. Which side goes higher? Tell me. This is science.
I guess it's a tie.
This is math.
It's a tie.
No, no. One of them has to go higher. Come on.
Really?
Right or,
you don't
right
care.
Or left.
A
right
shrug.
Or left.
Okay.
I don't
see.
Care.
Let's see. You know what? It was your left.
Okay. Usual Suspects moves on.
Okay. Well, that's where I'm voting too, actually. Maybe because I just caught it on late night TV and couldn't stop watching it. So it gets the slight advantage. Reservoir Dogs.
Okay.
Tarantino versus Boys in the Hood. Early Ooh. 90s writing, directing debuts matchup. Tarantino in 92, Singleton in 93. Both films set in L.A. and feature emotional moments between tough guys in violent situations. Dogs made all of the best of the 90s list except Slants. And it was number five on flick chart. Singleton's Boys only made the Paste list. And Singleton was nominated for Best Director and Original Screenplay at those Oscars. Where are you going?
This is really hard. So Reservoir is a Tarantino I'm pretty much entirely on board with.
Yep.
You know I have my issues with him, but in this case,
a sacred
I'm pretty
cow
much there.
Film in the
Boys
past.
In the Hood. Loved when it came out. Have seen it since, but it's been a long time. Could be entirely wrong, but I feel like in my memory, Reservoir is the more fully formed film for an early effort, and I'm going to vote that way.
Okay. That's the correct way to go. Seven versus Starship Troopers. We've got nothing clever to try to connect these films. You simply have David Fincher's movie that made all of the best of the 90s lists versus Paul Verhoeven's movie that made all of the list except for Pace. Starship Troopers just coming into the tournament via play-in, edging out Three Kings. So your choice, mine is Seven. I love Seven.
Do you
I
really?
Love that David Fincher movie.
Have you seen it recently?
Probably have not actually seen it in a long time. I mean, I saw it on DVD after it came out two or three times because it was one of those films that I remember in college showing to people, introducing
them
to it, and loving it more every time I watched it.
I think I'm going to go that way, even though I'm not a huge fan of Seven. Haven't revisited it in its entirety in a while either, and I do wonder how it would hold up. But we talked about this with the play-in matchups as well. Sort of late to the game on Starship Troopers, didn't see it initially, had already been aware of its reclamation as this satire by critics a few years later. So my relationship to that isn't super strong. I guess I'll go with you on Seven.
Relax. Will you, for crying out? What's got into you? I'm breaking your balls a little bit. That's all. I'm only kidding with you.
Sometimes you don't sound like you're kidding. You know, there's a lot of people around.
I mean, I'm only kidding with you. We're having a party. I mean, I just came home. I haven't seen you in a long time, and I'm breaking your balls, and you're right away, you're getting fresh. I'm sorry. I don't mean to offend you.
I'm sorry, too. It's okay. No problem.
Okay, salud. I'll go home and get your f***ing shine box.
Motherf***er!
8 more matchups to get to. You just heard Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas, Frank Vincent's Billy Bats with Joe Pesci there in that classic gangster movie. Goodfellas, the number 2 seed in the tourney. It lost to Pulp Fiction 60% to 40% in the Sweet 16 round of last year's Pantheon Madness. So we'll see if Goodfellas can earn some revenge. It's going up against, how about this for a pairing, Josh? There's Something About Mary.
Oh no, I have to vote against another comedy. Yikes.
Well, you don't have to.
You know,
and that's where we went.
Let's just say Goodfellas, I think, also works as a comedy.
There's a lot of humor in Goodfellas.
I'm serious.
No, I know. Yeah. I laugh at a lot of it, and I know many others do as well. It made all of the best of the 90s list. Number 1 for the AV Club and number 1 for Rolling Stone. Number 4 on Flick Chart. There's Something About Mary falls into the Insider category, the Truman Show category. Didn't make any lists. Somehow completely overlooked, but we talked to Brett Merriman about it, one of our listeners. We've talked to various people, and me and Sam, at the end of the day, we just felt like it's one of those comedies that was such a big deal at the time it came out.
Huge.
It was a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it deserves recognition here. Now, does it deserve to get beaten swiftly by Goodfellas in round 1? Maybe not, but that's probably what's going to happen. So let's get on then to that second matchup where I'm hoping the Coen brothers are going to have yet another film that advances over Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park.
Yeah, so Jurassic Park was the clear winner over Titanic for me in the play-in. Miller's Crossing is the clear winner over Jurassic Park for me here.
Isn't Miller's Crossing your favorite, Coens?
I have it ranked there right now, yeah. And, you know, that can change with the Coens,
yeah.
But it's the one, not only the one that introduced me to them as really master filmmakers, but started to open my eyes to what the movies themselves could be. And the fact that there's someone behind the camera exerting that sort of decision-making and control. So Miller's Crossing, I'm going to be voting for quite a while.
Yeah, it was the first Coen Brothers movie that I ever saw, with the exception of Raising Arizona. Except at the time I saw Raising Arizona 100 times as a kid, I didn't know who the Coen Brothers were.
Sure, yeah.
Miller's Crossing was the first movie where I knew it was them because I was just starting to become a cinephile.
Right.
So it was an important movie for me, and yet I've said this on the show before, I have it ranked fairly low. I want to say it's still in my top 10 Coen Brothers movies, but it probably should be a lot higher than it is. It's just one badly in need of a rewatch. I haven't seen it, honestly, since I think I was 17 years old.
Oh, we got to do it.
Seriously.
We should do it.
So for me, of all these Madness movies, Miller's Crossing is the one maybe most in need of that rewatch, and maybe it will happen. Hopefully, it will advance for me over Jurassic Park, but I've got a bad feeling about that one, Josh. I think we're in trouble.
You're probably right.
You know?
I wasn't even thinking about that.
It's rough. Okay. Magnolia, another Paul Thomas Anderson matchup versus Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother, the All About My Estranged Father matchup. Magnolia made all of the best of the 90s lists except for the AV Club. All About My Mother made only the AV Club and Rolling Stones list. So what do you think?
Maybe unfair because I saw All About My Mother within the last year, I think, maybe a little more than that for the first time. So it's fresh and to me should be the winner here. I'm also not as over the moon about Magnolia as I know a lot of people are. For a lot of people, was the introduction to PTA.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's still great things about it. We've talked about him in various shows, some of the sequences and performances in Magnolia. But it's also for me, and I remember thinking this at the time, someone who is just throwing all of his prodigious skills on the screen in a way that maybe didn't have that control that he showed later.
I agree with that.
Really good film.
Yeah.
But in this matchup, I'm very comfortable going with All About My Mother.
I think we're in lockstep here because Almodovar, not only do I love his work, but I think All About My Mother is my favorite Almodovar.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, and Magnolia is near the bottom, even though I'm a fan, near the bottom of my PTA films ranking. So I can't believe I'm going against PTA, but
yeah.
I would love to see All About My Mother advance. Seems unlikely, but we're going to put our 2 votes behind it. How about this offbeat office set comedy matchup, Being John Malkovich, Spike Jonze versus Mike Judge's Office Space?
Ooh.
Another comedy.
I know.
They're both comedies.
So different, though. So absolutely different comedies. And
clear winner for me. I love Malkovich.
I know.
But I love Office Space, too, so
I think I'm going to go. I'm going to give it to Office Space this time.
Okay.
I think similar reasoning to Magnolia. You have artists involved in Being John Malkovich that are right about there. You know, right about really where they're going to get to, but maybe not entirely. And then Office Space, it just makes me laugh.
Yeah, It's really funny.
It's very funny.
Okay. Unforgiven versus Metropolitan. This is the anybody don't want to get killed better head out the back matchup. I'm talking to you, Metropolitan. This is not a fair gunfight.
No.
I mean, Metropolitan's, kind of like, it's fine. I'm glad Whit Stillman's represented. That's why he's here.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I made the case for him. But going against, for me, maybe a top five film in this bracket, in this entire tournament.
Let's give him his moment and move on.
And move on to Trainspotting versus Clueless, the memorable 90s soundtrack matchup. Both films also feature solid ensembles and iconic 90s star turns. Ewan McGregor's Renton versus Alicia Silverstone's Cher. So is it Danny Boyle or is it Amy Heckerling? Josh?
Maybe it's the bad aftertaste of T2,
which
I know you don't have.
No, I liked it.
You do remember it came out, because
I do.
Kind of like,
it was like my number,
it released last year and no
13
one
or 14 film
talked
of the
about
year.
It again, except for you.
Yeah.
And I revisited Trainspotting ahead of that, so it's relatively fresh in my mind, and it held up. Thought it was really strong. But having voted for Clueless over Election, I'm going to stick with it. I want Clueless to keep moving on. You do too. No, you don't. Just vote Trainspotting. Just do it.
It's really hard, though, because I can honestly say that if I had to pick one to watch right now, I'd rather watch Clueless. I've never adored Trainspotting the way you would assume.
Okay.
I would, based on the fact that our show is called Film Spotting. You would never think that I'm just kind of, just kind of okay with Trainspotting.
I see an open door here, then, for you to vote Clueless. Go through that door, Adam.
It's Trainspotting.
Oh, come on.
Okay, this is another one that's going to hurt you, Josh. It's going to hurt you. It's going to cut deep to pick The Matrix or The Blair Witch Project, the influential genre movie matchup. The Wachowski sisters, Matrix, changed the way action movies looked. The Blair Witch Project introduced or perfected, you could argue, the found footage horror genre. You love The Blair Witch Project, but are you really going to put it ahead of The Matrix?
Easily.
Easily?
Absolutely easily.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Uncalled for. Yeah, I mean,
no chance.
The Blair Witch Project, I forget where I have it ranked in, you know, top horror films of all time, but it's up there. It's really,
it's good.
Unique.
Yeah.
Never copied. Mm-hmm. And obviously the filmmakers never managed anything close to it again. Combination of fear and form that I hope goes very far in this tournament, but will likely lose in this round.
Yeah, it's done. It's so done.
I do
it's
like
taking
the
wrong pill.
I mean, everything you said about The Matrix is correct.
Oh, it's a masterpiece. It's an action sci-fi masterpiece. Okay, our final matchup in this region, a documentary. The only, Josh, documentary. I don't know if that will sway your voting. The only documentary in the entire tournament, and that does hurt me, but we have Steve James, Hoop Dreams, versus The Thin Red Line, as Sam has it here, the 250 hours of footage matchup. The Steve James doc was literally whittled down to 3 hours from 250 hours, and Malick's first film in 20 years is famous for the scenes and performances that the final three-hour cut doesn't include, all those scenes with Adrian Brody, Mickey Rourke, Viggo Mortensen, and Billy Bob Thornton.
What will sway me is the fact that Hoop Dreams is a masterpiece.
Yes.
And Thin Red Line, I know many consider also a Malick masterpiece. For me, he's getting there. He's moving his way towards the Tree of Life, but there are some of those still mannered elements to the Thin Red Line, which I like, that until he fully found a way to employ them in the Tree of Life, I wasn't as sold on as others. So yeah, Hoop Dreams for me.
Hoop Dreams for me as well, and that's easy because not only am I a fan of James and I want a documentary to advance, but The Thin Red Line, for me, I've said this on the show before, one of those movies I desperately need to see again, reconsider, but when I saw it originally in the theater, still the only time that I've seen it, it was for me the first miss in the Malick canon up to that point because I was such a fan of Badlands and Days of Heaven and The New World and then The Tree of Life, but as I'm saying this out loud, I actually wonder if it's possible that I wasn't aware of it being a misfire at the time. I think The Thin Red Line honestly might have been the first Malick movie I'd seen.
Okay.
I think I saw that when it came out in the 90s, still at that point where I'm really getting into cinema, then went back. And so I don't think my head was quite prepared for the Malick experience yet.
Yeah,
I was going in knowing of the lore of Terrence Malick, but having not seen one of his movies before, I don't think I could fully deal with it. And maybe if I had seen Badlands and Days of Heaven at that point, it would have made more sense to me. But I was lost, honestly, watching The Thin Red Line, and I think it's going to have a tough time against Hoop Dreams, but I know a lot of people do adore it. That brings us to our final region, our final set of 16 movies.
Granddad was facing death. He knew it. None of those boys had any illusions, but ever leaving that island alive. So 3 days before the Japanese took the island, your granddad asked a gunner on an Air Force transport named a Wanaki, man he never met before in his life, to deliver to his infant son, who he'd never seen in the flesh, his gold watch.
Christopher Walken, of course, in Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, the tourney's overall number one seed, the runner-up in last year's Pantheon Madness, where it did lose to The Godfather, and it's going up against David Lynch's Wild at Heart. And I love the little scribbles here that I hadn't read before sitting down that Sam put in our notes, Josh. Nicolas Cage in the Travolta role, Laura Dern in the Uma Thurman role, Pulp Fiction is better.
Oh,
that's his unpopular opinion. I love Nicolas Cage, and I love Laura Dern, and I love Wild at Heart. But Sam's crazy.
Yeah, that's a little out there.
They're both perfectly in Pulp Fiction.
That's almost like what Travolta was meant to do, is be in Pulp Fiction. He had to make all those other movies first so that he could be in Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm. So, is it a clear winner?
Yeah, it's
Pulp Fiction. We wanted some Lynch on here. It's unfair that it's going against Pulp Fiction in round one. In an earlier version of this bracket, it was still going to get killed, but I actually liked my matchup better. It was Pulp Fiction versus Close Up, which to me, I just like the way they're fractured stories and they're not told in a straightforward way. It at least made them a little more connected, even though they're vastly different movies. But here, Pulp Fiction, I do think, should beat Wild at Heart. Out of Sight, a Steven Soderbergh movie that is in the Film Spotting Pantheon, and I think the only Steven Soderbergh movie from the 90s that is in the Film Spotting Madness tournament. It's going up against Saving Private Ryan from Steven Spielberg. The Dennis Farina is in both of these 1998 movies matchup.
Oh, I'm glad we have that.
What do you think?
So, yeah, I think I'm going to go Out of Sight here. I think that so Saving Private Ryan has masterful sequences and then some questionable things. For me, the framing device has never worked very well. Out of Sight it's just clockwork.
Yeah. It's great.
Out of Sight is
my favorite Soderbergh film.
I think it
film.
Might be my favorite of his, too.
So. Wow. We actually agree on something Soderbergh
yeah,
related.
Yeah, Soderbergh. That's
I'm
kind
shocked.
Of a surprise.
Okay, Toy Story beat out Toy Story 2 to make it into the dance, and it's going up against The Sixth Sense.
Oh, man.
From M.
This
Night
is really interesting.
Shyamalan.
How do you even think about these two
I don't
together?
Know. This is one of the toughest ones for me, actually, because I really like both films.
Yeah.
I don't have an incredibly passionate feeling for both films. I think both are really, really good. And if I had to watch one again right now or wanted to make sure that future generations saw it, that one, when I ask myself that question, it points me a little bit more in the direction of Toy Story.
Toy Story, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think
agree.
It's more iconic and timeless
for sure.
And needs to advance. Okay, Schindler's List, more Spielberg, going up against another animated film, The Iron Giant.
Oh, man. Am I just going to...
Brad Bird.
Am I going to knock out Spielberg from this tournament?
Yeah.
In my first round of voting?
The fear of the other matchup, which is, I think, a good way to put it. Obviously, Brad Bird's old school animated film and Spielberg's best picture winner. It did make all of the best of the 90s list. It was actually number two on pace list. I think this might be a case where I just have to admit that the challenge of watching Schindler's List, because of the subject matter, even though it's ultimately a redemptive film, and a hopeful film in some ways, the experience of watching it is so tough for me that it's very easy to choose a delightful movie like The Iron Giant over it. For me, it is.
Yeah. And I don't even know how to think about these two either. Schindler's List, I don't know. I would definitely rank Spielberg films ahead of it. So I'm not saying that it's his ultimate masterwork, but I think alongside The Iron Giant, it just has to move on for me. I'm going to go Schindler's List. Pains me to vote against animation again, but I'm going to have to do it in this case.
Okay. The actually not at all safe matchup, Fight Club, David Fincher versus Todd Haynes' movie, Safe. Fight Club made all of the best of the 90s lists and was number three on Flick Chart. And here's the thing about Safe. It was a movie that, we'll confess, Sam and me, we didn't really consider it for the top 64 or even the top 75 or so. But the more we looked at those lists, Rolling Stone had it on the best of the 90s, AV Club and Slant, Todd Haynes, his psychological horror character study with Julianne Moore. It was actually number 3 on the Rolling Stone best of the 90s list. It did make us think it's a movie that belongs here. Even if it's going to get crushed by Fight Club, it's just going to get demolished like Brad Pitt's face by Edward Norton about 3/4 of the way through that film. We still want Todd Haynes, and that movie represented. It feels like one of the best films of the 90s, or at least many critics seem to feel that way, Josh.
It's also one of the best films of the 90s I have not seen, so I can't vote in this one.
Okay.
I'd probably love it, too. Like, it sounds right up my alley, and as much as I like Haynes' other stuff, though Fight Club, I'm also really high on. I do think it's one of Fincher's best.
Okay.
So, I can't vote anyway.
You can't vote. It's a tough one for me because Fight Club is not going to win another matchup the rest of this tournament for me. I just don't love it that much. But I do have it ahead of Safe. Barton Fink, the fourth and final Coen Brothers film in this tournament, and one of my favorites against Leon the Professional, the memorable scene set in a hallways matchup. And yes, Leon, it's a fine movie.
Goodbye, Leon.
But goodbye. Barton Fink moves on. Chungking Express, Wong Kar-wai's movie that made all of the best of the 90s list. Number 5, AV Club. Number 9, Rolling Stone. Versus a movie I love, Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho. The Meditation on Loneliness matchup. Van Sant's riff on Shakespeare's Henry IV features River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves as philosophical street hustlers.
This is such a good
wow,
pairing.
This is this hard. Is such it's a such good a good pairing, and it's so hard because I adore both films.
I think I'm going to go Chungking Express.
I think Chungking, just as an achievement, it needs to move on, and it needs to have that recognition, as much as that pains me to say, because Idaho is just a favorite.
You feel like you're voting also against the characters
you
in
do.
These films,
yeah.
Which is what hurts more than voting against the movies
well
themselves, but I think I'm going to have to choose Chungking Express.
Okay. Our final matchup, and Josh, I promise you, as we were about to embark on Madness, that there was going to be one matchup that was going to test the very fabric of your being.
Okay.
That was going to maybe send you out of the room screaming, tearing up your bracket, never wanting to play Film Spotting Madness again. Let's
just
see.
Just get to it.
Let's see if I've overstated it and now overhyped it. But you have to choose one of these films. Only one can continue.
Yeah, I know how it works.
Okay.
This is Princess Mononoke, isn't it?
Princess Mononoke, which I know you love. Hayao Miyazaki.
Yeah.
Going against your beloved, your favorite Quentin Tarantino movie, Jackie Brown.
No.
Only one can go on. It's the Josh Larson special matchup. Jackie Brown.
Best Tarantino.
Made all of the best of the 90s lists except the AV Clubs. Princess Mononoke made all of the lists except for Slants. Which one do you choose?
And I did just watch Mononoke on the big screen like a month ago.
This is a sweep for me, Tarantino. Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, and Jackie Brown. And
going,
I love Miyazaki.
You're going with all of them.
And I love Mononoke, but
this
Jackie
is the
Brown's
only
wonderful.
Miyazaki.
Yeah.
This is okay. All right. Is this the best Miyazaki? That's the only way I can think
of it.
Do
you have your ranking?
So I've got, I think I might have, there's one or two of his. Talk some more while I research this.
I will vamp here as we are going to hear from
a way out.
The father of Film Spotting Madness here in a second. We did get a voicemail from Mike Merrigan in Dover, New Hampshire. He's going to close us out and give us a little bit of an overview of the tournament as we, of course, do plan to have our bit of fun where me, you, Sam, and Mike fill out our brackets and we try to predict the winner. And you've been notoriously bad at this. Have you only lost twice or have you lost all 3 years?
I wonder if we didn't have
maybe
a competition the first year.
But the last two you've lost. And
I
you
have
had
watched,
to watch bad
I have
Adam Sandler movies.
Netflix Adam Sandler movies.
That's
let's
right.
be particular.
Okay. Do you have a ruling, Josh?
I do have a ruling. I have a ruling. Oh, I feel so much better. I am also voting Jackie Brown because I do think My Neighbor Totoro is
the better Miyazaki.
A smidge better than Princess Mononoke.
Okay.
I will hope that helps me sleep at night.
We can't wait to get into the voting, start seeing the results. Sam and I only hit refresh on these polls about 5,700 times a day. It's not that we're into this at all. And we'll see who's going to do better in our little matchup. Mike Merrigan, let's hear from him. He needs to weigh in before we can officially launch this year's tournament.
Hi, Adam, Josh, Sam, and Film Spotting Nation. It's Film Spotting Madness founding father Mike Merrigan calling from Dover, New Hampshire. I'm calling to kick off the 2018 Film Spotting Madness tournament. I'm happy to say this year's bracket is a nearly perfect representation of the best of 90s cinema. It also doesn't disappoint in the impossible, brutal, Sophie's Choice style matchups we've all come to know and love. There are heartbreakers like L.A. Confidential versus Glengarry Glen Ross in round one. There are potential bracket busters like Seven versus Reservoir Dogs likely to show up in round two and make or break who wins the whole thing. Also, at some point, listeners may have to choose between Schindler's List and a Toy Story movie because you people are sadistic. Looking at the top seeds in each region, we might expect a Pulp Fiction, Goodfellas, Silence of the Lambs, Final Four. The 90s was nothing if not a decade of hitmen, gangsters, and serial killers. Breaking down each section, the smart money is on Fargo to go the distance because it has the easiest path to victory. And if history tells us anything, Film Spotting Nation loves them some Coen brothers. Therefore, I assume Josh will definitely pick Rushmore, and Adam will just curl into a ball and mutter, out of sight, until this whole thing is over. Best of luck to all of you, and best of luck to the entire Films Nation. Have fun, everyone.
Thank you, Mike, for the vote of confidence. We can officially begin that bracket contest, as I mentioned, will result in a loser watching an Adam Sandler movie. What's this nonsense I heard about you getting some tips from Film Spotting listeners at the Seattle meetup you just had?
Yeah, they thought I could use a little help in this prediction bracket. So we talked strategy.
Oh, yeah.
We'll see how it pans out. I'm not too confident.
No, nor should you. Especially because, like clockwork, Adam Sandler and Netflix have teamed up for The Week Of, debuting on Netflix April 27th. It's ready for you, Josh. You can't put this one off 8 months again.
Yeah.
You're going to deal with it. You're going to suffer your punishment.
I squeezed, I can't remember the name of it now.
Sandy Wexler
right in under the line. It's almost like, I think at this point, Sandler knows we have this.
I think it is
going on. That's the only reason he keeps making these.
It totally makes sense. It's just 2 weeks after the Madness champion is crowned. It's got Sandler. It's got Chris Rock, Steve Buscemi, and Mudbound's Rob Morgan, who's really good in Mudbound.
I feel the worst for Rob Morgan.
It's co-written and directed by Triumph the Insult comic dog himself, Robert Smigel. The plot, Josh, because we need you to get ready.
So I'm a little intrigued now, the Smigel connection.
I'm with you there.
Okay.
The parents of a soon-to-be married couple make the final preparations for the wedding ceremony.
Okay. It sounds like a laugh a minute.
It sounds harmless enough. Voting for Film Spotting Madness is open now at filmspotting.net/madness. Please vote now. Invite your friends. Polls go live every week, Friday at midnight Central Time, and they close the following Monday at 5 p.m. Central Time. And this was mentioned earlier. It was actually a listener in Brooklyn, John Dembski, who said, to minimize the frequency with which more recognized films are the runaway winners, maybe we should remind voters to only vote in the matchups where they have seen both films. So, Josh, you did state that there are two movies out of the final 64.
I think there were two
I think that you still need to see, so you didn't vote in those matchups. And hopefully that will encourage some of those lesser, widely seen movies, but still beloved movies to have a shot.
And you and Sam will be banging on doors if someone votes for a movie they haven't seen, right?
Of course. We're going to be monitoring, and everyone who votes for Jurassic Park, we're going to be tracking your IP addresses. That is our show. If you have any thoughts on any aspect of it, we'd love to hear it. You can send us an MP3 file or leave us a short voicemail, and we may use it in next week's show. 312-264-0744. Our email address, as always, is feedback@filmspotting.net.
At filmspotting.net, you can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. Guess what? At the site is also where you can do your Film Spotting Madness voting. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find them both in Apple Podcasts or through your preferred podcast app.
Out in limited release this weekend, Loveless from the director of 2014's Leviathan, not the one with the fish heads that Josh loves so much. Don't worry about that, guys. Out in wide release, Death Wish, Eli Roth, Bruce Willis. Enough said. Red Sparrow, also out, the Jennifer Lawrence spy thriller directed by Francis Lawrence. And next week on the show, it does look like we have decided to discuss J-Law in Red Sparrow ahead of Duncan Jones' Mute. And we will get into that madness round of 32. Or I see, while we're recording, Sam is slacking me thoughts on Film Spotting Madness and wondering if we need to let the first round breathe for an extra week. Who knows? We might just do that.
When is Sam not slacking you thoughts?
I think he's thinking about Madness 24/7.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and the aforementioned Sam Van Halkeren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Jeremy Wellhausen. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you enjoyed this show, please give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. That way we can reach new listeners. Our music this week is from Loma. It comes from their self-titled debut album. More information is at lomamusic.bandcamp.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
I took Sophie to see Cabaret on Sunday. It's playing at the Paramount in Aurora.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Have you been there? It's a nice theater.
I have never been there, but that's kind of in the old stomping grounds in terms of entertainment coverage, Aurora, Naperville. Mm-hmm. So, you know, had to write a lot of just kind of press release type stuff for their productions.
I've seen, well, we saw Jesus Christ Superstar there, and it was good. I think Cabaret is only the second show I've been to there. But it was funny because Sophie and I are walking in, and we're almost up to the ticket taker, which the ticket takers aren't at the front. They're more like when you're ready to walk into the theater.
Okay.
And before we get up to the woman there, this older woman says, "Sir, sir," and grabs me. And she says, "Now, you know that this play is quite risque."
Oh, she was worried.
Oh, yeah. Because I was with Sophie.
For Sophie, yeah.
This play is quite risque. And I can't remember exactly what she said. She goes, well, first she asked me, "Have you seen this before?"
Okay.
And I said, "No, I haven't." And she goes, "Well, it's quite risque. There are the cabaret, the nightclub numbers.
This
with
is not the Rockettes,
nudity."
Sir.
And I'm like, "Well, yeah, I've seen the movie, and I'm familiar with the subject matter, and yeah, we're fine, we're all good." She's like, "And you're okay with the Nazi stuff?" And I'm like, "Yep, I know about the Nazis. I've
She's
seen the
go
movie."
She's going to go through every objectionable element with
you. It is funny, though, because in the play, and it was a good production, there's a part, it either ends the first act or it's just right before the first act where a guy does a Nazi salute. This character who has been a friend, and then they discover that he's really a Nazi.
Okay.
And he does the salute, and he's wearing the armband, and you felt everybody just collectively tighten.
Sure.
In the theater. You just couldn't avoid it. It was interesting. And but we did that. And then we didn't even get then more than 5 or 6 more feet before we got to the ticket taker. Someone else stopped us and said, "Now you know that this is PG-13 basically." And I go, yep, we're all good. And Sophie, of course, who thinks she's more grown up than she is anyway. It's like, what do they think? I'm 5? You know, she's like, I can, you know. And of course, for someone who's obsessed with Rent and stuff, like what?
Yeah.
She's been exposed to big boy and big girl subject matter. Like she's not afraid of Cabaret.
They're very concerned for the hearts and minds of the youth.
Apparently so.
They're in Aurora. Well, good for them.
I guess so, right?
Looking out for the kids.
So when was the last time you watched M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable?
Probably not since it came out, I bet. And I liked it quite
a
bit.
Did you like it?
Yeah. Doesn't hold
too.
Up. Doesn't hold up?
No, actually.
It's really good.
It's really good.
Yeah. I've heard people like praising it in the years since, like saying this is one of his better films by far. Isn't there a sequel in the works?
Well, I mean.
Or something like that?
You never see Split?
No, I've never seen it.
Okay, yeah. You didn't talk about it on the show. I did, maybe not for a full review, or maybe I reviewed it with someone else. I know I talked about it for at least a few minutes on the show, but it must not have been with you.
I don't know. I didn't see
if
it.
If you've
I don't
seen
remember.
Split, you know how it ties back to Unbreakable. And so, yes, you know that there's another movie coming out.
Okay.
And just like with Unbreakable, I was unsatisfied with the way Split ended, the very end, the kind of coda. And that was my big issue with Unbreakable, too. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, I really loved the movie. And I wrote a review of it back in 2000, I think, when it came out. But I really liked it. Haven't seen it since. Maybe seen 1 or 2 scenes on TV, but have not ever really gone back in. And I think it was Saturday night. And it's one of those cases where it's like midnight and you're still flipping channels, laying in bed, and Sarah's fast asleep. And I stop on Unbreakable. And what actually did catch my eye, if it had been maybe even almost any other scene. If it had just been, let's say, a close-up of Bruce Willis, maybe I would have turned it. I've been like, oh, it's Unbreakable. I don't care. But the shot was so interesting because it must have been early in the movie, as I remember it. It's where he's just survived the train accident.
Okay.
Right? So it's got to be in the first 15 minutes or something because I think it opens on the train. And he's in the hospital and a doctor is talking to him. And the shot is the camera feels like it's looking down a hallway, but it's in another patient's room. And in the foreground of the shot is like the only other person who, as of this moment, is still alive. And all you see is their body kind of moving.
I
think while it's being worked on, I don't know, but you see this body in the foreground and you see in the background then Bruce Willis being talked to by the doctor, being looked at funny. He's mystified at how he could be spotless. He just came out of this thing unscathed. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the shot is set up so that both of the people talking can't stop focusing on that body and then that person, it really caught my eye. And so I kept watching the movie. And I only did finally shut it off with about 15 minutes left. I checked, there's about 15 minutes left. And I think, honestly, Josh, there was a part of me that, like, didn't want to watch the last 15 minutes because I didn't want to have the experience spoiled for me like it did the first time.
I don't even remember the final moments of it.
Well, it ends, I'll say, it ends with some text where it tells us what happens to the Samuel L. Jackson character.
Okay.
And it felt to me just totally, even though you could argue it's completely in keeping with the rest of the movie, it felt completely out of touch for me, and it just ruined almost everything that came before. I don't know that I'd still have that harsh of a reaction because I overall did like the movie, but I'm just saying I had not watched this movie. I watched an hour and 20 minutes of it, and for better or worse, and for me it's for better, there is not a single shot in the movie that isn't fussed over in some
sure.
way, that isn't just overly detailed and rich and thought out for a particular reason. Every single shot, including close-ups of Bruce Willis. Like Shyamalan just does not waste a frame in that movie.
That's what he was doing at that stage in his career. And for some reason, it wasn't there early on, maybe because he was still learning, obviously. But it's like he hit this magical moment of having that sort of masterful control. I think it continues in Signs. I'm a huge fan of Signs. And I stuck, as we've talked about on the show, stuck with him fairly long, and then it just kind of evaporated.
Mm. You see elements of it in Split.
Sure.
Coming back.
Yeah, you'll see
he's
little
still
flickers.
Got an eye.
Yeah, but what you're talking about,
remarkable.
That absolute control. Yeah. So I just pulled it up on my site. The last minute twist here is a disappointment.
Mm-hmm. There you
so
go.
Whatever it was, it didn't work for me either.
It is, but then I was also, one of the things that surprised me, having not seen it in 18 years, is I thought that part of the twist was that we discover only really in the end who Samuel L. Jackson is. And that's not really the case. What I mean is, yes, we find out to the extent he'll commit some acts in order to be this character that he's created for himself. But from the very first time he meets Bruce Willis, I just didn't remember this, he's already laying out this universe from the moment he meets him, where it's like, I think you're my counter.
I do remember
I think
that.
You're my counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're the opposite of me. And so I just didn't remember that. But I really like Sam Jackson in it, who's, of course, always good. But he's really good here. Willis is phenomenal. I think it's an exercise in that kind of stoicism and the stillness.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if he decided with this movie, I'm going to push the limits of stillness
and
yet see how compelling I can still be. And he is really good, and Robin Wright's really good. And then it just all that was adding up, and we get to that point about 20 minutes left in the movie where he is at the breakfast table the night after he's finally done his first like heroic act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really finally tried to be a hero, and he's sitting across from his son while Robin Wright is making breakfast, and it all came back to me the moment what was about to happen. Oh, he's gonna push the newspaper over to him, and it's gonna be their little secret. Like, look, I'm the guy in the story, and he's gonna recognize it. And I didn't remember anything else about how it played out. I just knew that's what was gonna happen. I'm telling you, I'm laying in bed at like 1:30 in the morning with wet eyes. With wet eyes, it made me so emotional. This father-son moment they were about to have before it happened, I was emotional. And then when he finally does turn the newspaper around and the kid starts bawling silently, but bawling, and then that makes Bruce Willis break down. Oh man,
I think
I was a blubbering mess watching Unbreakable.
I think you need more sleep is the issue there.
Yeah, it is. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.